and going off on the vellum,
and discover new details in paintings by Nicholas Hilliard, Mary Cassatt and Jan van Eyck.
It's a signature in the manner of graffiti.
The new series of Moving Pictures, with me, Cathy Fitzgerald, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Tuesday afternoon at 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Friday, the 10th of April. This is Today with Nick Robinson in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
Good morning, the headlines today. President Trump has accused Iran of failing to abide by the ceasefire deal by not allowing oil shipments to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. Israel has launched more attacks on Lebanon after saying it wants direct peace talks with the government in Beirut.
Also on today's programme, we have one of the first interviews with an Epstein survivor after First Lady Melania Trump's extraordinary speech last night, where she denied any ties to the convicted paedophile and called on Congress to hear survivors' testimony.
I felt like she was taking a stand to say that, you know, something needs to be done here. So I was like, wait a second, that's kind of a bold move. That's a big statement.
This is the beautiful sound of the greenfinch. According to the RSPB, that call may now be falling silent. We'll find out why your garden bird feeder might be to blame. And
we'd been looking for my old base for years.
Where did it go?
Must be an answer, you know?
The remarkable story of the historic base that powered the Beatles and its rediscovery decades after it was stolen from Paul McCartney. Before all of that, though, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
President Trump has accused Iran of breaching its ceasefire deal, saying it has done a very poor job of allowing oil tankers to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. On social media, Mr. Trump said the current situation was not the agreement. Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon have also exchanged fire overnight, creating tension ahead of peace talks in Pakistan this weekend. Daniel Gisimoni reports from Jerusalem.
Israel said it had struck Hezbollah rocket launchers in Lebanon overnight, with the Iran-backed group saying it had fired rockets at several places in Israel. The fighting comes after President Trump was quoted as saying Israel would be more low-key in Lebanon, comments widely seen as him asking Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to be more restrained. Israel's assault in Lebanon on Wednesday killed more than 300 people. Mr. Trump, in late-night social media posts, said Iran was failing to keep to the ceasefire agreement by doing a very poor job of letting oil through the Strait of Hormuz. Some would say Iran was being dishonourable, he added, and had warned Iran against charging ships transit fees. In a statement read on Iranian state TV, the country's supreme leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, was quoted saying he reserved the right to retribution for US-Israeli attacks on his country and its allies, implying Hezbollah in Lebanon, which Israel and the US claims isn't covered by the ceasefire.
Sir Starmer has spoken by phone to President Trump. Downing Street says in a call from Qatar last night, the Prime Minister set out the discussions he'd had with leaders in the Gulf and that he and Mr. Trump spoke about the need for a practical plan to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Sir Keir has written a newspaper article saying the way the UK emerges from the war in the Middle East will define the country for a generation. Our political correspondent Jack Fenwick reports.
Writing in The Guardian, the Prime Minister said the war in Iran must become a line in the sand. He said previous governments had been found wanting when dealing with global crises and pledged to make the country more resilient. Sir Keir said the world was volatile and that Britain needed to prepare for more frequent economic shocks. Speaking in the Gulf region yesterday, Sir Keir said he was fed up of families' bills going up because of the actions of Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. The Conservatives and Reform called on the government to increase energy security by drilling in the North Sea. The Liberal Democrats and Greens said the UK couldn't rely on America and should pursue closer ties with Europe.
Survivors of the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein have accused the US First Lady, Melania Trump, of shifting the burden onto victims after she used a public statement to suggest they should testify before Congress about their experiences. They said asking more of them was a deflection of responsibility, not justice. Mrs. Trump made a rare appearance at the White House to deny having any links to Epstein, describing claims circulating online as defamatory. Nelly Taufik reports.
There was no advance notice that the purpose of this statement would be for Melania Trump to reject claims she had connections with Jeffrey Epstein. The First Lady said she never had a relationship with Epstein or his accomplice, Ghislaine Maxwell, was not introduced to her husband by Epstein, and was not one of his victims. She called on Congress to hold public hearings for Epstein survivors to tell their stories. What prompted her to make this statement at this particular moment is unclear, given her lawyers have long threatened legal action and successfully had material online removed, including an article on the Daily Beast website that claimed Mrs. Trump was very involved in Epstein's social circles.
Russia has announced a ceasefire in Ukraine for Orthodox Easter starting tomorrow afternoon and lasting 32 hours. President Putin said his defense ministry and chief of staff had been ordered to stop fighting on all fronts and that Ukraine was expected to follow its example. President Zelensky said Kiev had already proposed a ceasefire and would act accordingly. From Kiev, our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
Ukraine had been calling for an Easter truce for some time, ignored by the Kremlin. Then Vladimir Putin announced that all Russian troops had been ordered to cease fire from Saturday afternoon through Easter Sunday. He said he expected Kiev to follow suit. That approach and tone will make people here bristle. But Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine is ready for what he called symmetrical steps. He said people needed an Easter free from threats and with real movement towards peace. The pause will be welcomed by soldiers along the front line and people across Ukraine, where missiles and drones continue to kill and injure civilians every day.
Chinese state media says President Xi has met Taiwan's opposition leader in Beijing. Zhang Liwen is the first Kuomintang party leader to visit China in a decade. Her trip has sparked debate in Taiwan, with critics, including some in her own party, accusing her of being too pro-Beijing. The trade body representing convenience stores in the UK says not enough is being done to tackle pop-up shops which are selling stolen and illegal goods. It says chocolate, which has been taken from legitimate high street retailers, is being sold in the same neighbourhood alongside illegal cigarettes and vapes. Here's our business correspondent Simon Browning.
Criminals are taking confectionery out of shops by the caseload to then put it back on sale in illegitimate businesses. The Association of Convenience Stores says its members are frustrated and can't compete with the criminals who rely on stolen and illegal products as well as not paying insurance or business rates and are able to undercut their prices. The Trading Standards Institute said its officers took illegitimate businesses selling illegal goods extremely seriously but said more funding was needed. The government said £30 million a year was spent tackling the illicit sale of tobacco and vapes by organised crime groups.
Simon Browning reporting.
Thank you, Jane. 7 minutes past six. Ben Rich is waiting for us at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Ben.
Yes, good morning to you, Nick. Thank you very much. And good morning to you as well. We are looking at a mostly fine start to this Friday morning with some spells of sunshine, but an area of low pressure will be approaching from the west. So that will mean things turn increasingly windy across western areas, gales developing later on, some outbreaks of rain also arriving. The wettest of the weather likely to be in Northern Ireland. But let's start our forecast in the southwest of England and Wales. We will see some limited sunny spells through the morning, but thicker cloud into the afternoon and some outbreaks of mostly light and patchy rain pushing northwards and eastwards. For the southeast of England, for the Midlands, Eastern England, Northern England and also southwest Scotland, we are looking at a largely dry day with some sunny spells in the morning, increasingly cloudy conditions during the afternoon and maybe some rain into the far west later on where the winds will also start to strengthen. Eastern and northern parts of Scotland, seeing a few showers this morning, but some good sunny spells, and some of those will continue into the afternoon. The best of the sunshine likely to be in Orkney and Shetland. For Northern Ireland, though, cloud quickly thickening during the morning. Some outbreaks of rain setting in during the afternoon. That rain turning increasingly heavy and persistent. Not a great afternoon rush hour across Northern Ireland. The winds picking up as well. There could be gales around the coast. Temperatures ranging from 7 or 8 degrees in Northern Ireland to around 13 in parts of eastern England. Through tonight, rain pushes eastwards, showers following on behind, windy in the west. Quite a windy weekend as well, with that mix of sunshine and heavy showers.
Thank you, Ben. Possibly too much to hope that that brief flash of sunshine might last, wasn't it? It's 9 minutes past six now. Let's take a first look at the morning papers today. And the Times says that the UK could face a reckoning from the US and that Britain has been told its contribution to the Iran war effort will be audited by the White House alongside other NATO members. President Trump has reportedly threatened to punish allies that he believes failed to take part. Downing Street has said it doesn't recognise that account. The Times also highlights comments by Keir Starmer, which it calls his strongest criticism yet of the US president, when he said people were fed up of the way US actions were pushing up household bills.
The Financial Times focuses on the impact on oil prices of the continued closure of the Strait of Hormuz, saying some benchmarks reached more than $100 a barrel yesterday. The paper quotes a former energy advisor to President Biden as saying, if the situation continues for a few more days, markets could decide the Strait is closed indefinitely. The Guardian has spoken to an oil tanker worker stranded in the Strait. They say 90% of the crew on their vessel don't want to traverse the Strait for safety reasons.
The Daily Telegraph this morning leads on Melania Trump's surprise speech, in which she denied being a victim of Jeffrey Epstein or ever having a relationship with him. According to the paper, the First Lady's intervention seemingly came out of the blue with little explanation or context from the White House.
We see you, Vlad, is the front page headline in the Mirror, which says the Royal Navy foiled three Russian submarines spying on Britain's vital underseas cables. The Eye has a similar lead, saying the Iran war has emboldened Moscow. It quotes the Defence Secretary John Healey as saying Russia is using the Middle East conflict as a distraction.
And the Daily Mail blames what it calls Red Ed's green idiocy for the maker of ChatGPT pausing a multi-billion pound investment in Britain. The paper says that OpenAI was put off by the Energy Secretary Ed Miliband's net zero policies. The Sun has a similar take on the story. How much more damage to our economy can one man do, it asks. A government spokesperson says they are continuing to work with OpenAI to strengthen the UK's computing capacity.
That is one of the stories aside from the war that we're going to be examining today. Let's turn at 11 minutes past six, though, to the latest on the conflict in the Middle East. Israel's Prime Minister has agreed to go low-key in Lebanon, Donald Trump claimed, even as attacks continued. Hugo Bacheca is our correspondent in Beirut. How is that being received where you are, Hugo, that news?
Well, Nick, I think for the Lebanese, the most important thing is a ceasefire. And that's still not happening because overnight there were more Israeli airstrikes in Lebanon. Hezbollah also carried out attacks against Israel. And the Israelis are saying that these attacks on Hezbollah are going to continue. So there was an element of American pressure, particularly after what happened here on Wednesday, the horror inflicted by those huge airstrikes, Israeli airstrikes, one of the deadliest days in Lebanon's recent history, more than 300 people killed. And there was the fear that this could derail the ceasefire with Iran. So the Americans put pressure on Israel to reduce the scale of these attacks here in Lebanon, and also to engage in negotiations with Lebanon. But here, what authorities are saying is that a ceasefire must come first before any talks, before any negotiations with Israel, because this is the main and perhaps the only offer they have to try to put an end to the violence. And obviously, this is a country still in mourning, still in shock after what happened here. And we are expecting dozens of funerals to happen today. And, you know, this day is likely to be a sad, somber day for many here in Lebanon.
For a long time, Benjamin Netanyahu has resisted the idea of negotiations with the Lebanese government. Is the view there that he was simply told he had to go along with that by Donald Trump?
Yeah, and I think the attacks that happened here, Nick, have been widely condemned. And, you know, we heard from the vice president, the American vice president, saying that the Israelis had agreed to reduce, you know, the violence and the intensity of the attacks here in Lebanon. And remember, days ago, I was here, you know, talking about how the Israelis believed that they had a window of opportunity here, if you like, to really degrade Hezbollah. Look, I live here in Lebanon. I've been covering this story for a very long time. I think we're talking here about the possibility of direct negotiations between the Israelis and the Lebanese, which would be historic because there's no diplomatic ties, relations between these two countries. But I think there is the real fear, the real possibility that once we stop talking about Lebanon, once, you know, world leaders stop talking about what is happening in the Middle East, we're going to go back to the status quo. And that is an armed Hezbollah here refusing to disarm, refusing to discuss the future of its weapons. Israel attacking Lebanon almost on a daily basis, and those attacks pretty much going unnoticed. And stuck in the middle, Lebanon, a nation unable to decide what it wants to be.
Hugo Pacheco in Beirut, thank you.
It is 14 minutes past six now. Melania Trump has given a surprise statement at the White House, distancing herself from the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, saying she wanted to clear her good name over rumours of links between them. Well, our North America correspondent, Simi Jolo Osho, told me more about what she said.
Yeah, it was very much unexpected. So Melania Trump basically denied having any knowledge of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse of his victims. She came out to address any sort of rumor that she had a sort of connection to him, a relationship with him, any rumors that she herself was a victim of Epstein's and that Jeffrey Epstein had introduced her to Donald Trump. She said all those rumors are false. She called them fake statements and fake images. She clarified how she knows Jeffrey Epstein. She said they only briefly crossed paths back in 2000. And she basically warned people to be cautious of what they believe, what they see online, and whether they believe what they see online. She said that any claims linking her and Jeffrey Epstein need to end today. And she said that online rumors are, quote, mean-spirited attempts to defame her. The big speculation as to why she decided to give the statement now. There is a lot of speculation that perhaps there's a big story that's about to break, and this is the White House getting their denial out there first.
That's interesting. I've spoken this morning to one of Jeffrey Epstein's, a survivor of his abuse, and she touched on that as well. We'll hear from her in the next hour of the programme. Simi, what reaction has there been to this so far, this intervention by Melania Trump?
I think the main sort of reaction has been surprise. And this is amongst everyone in Washington, including the press, such as Fox News, which is a favorite of President Trump's, and amongst lawmakers. We've heard from members of Congress who are part of the committee investigating Jeffrey Epstein's crimes, who some have applauded Melania Trump for speaking out and say they agree with her that there should be a public hearing with the survivors of Jeffrey Epstein. But some have said that, look, it should be the government, Melania Trump's husband and his cabinet, speaking to Epstein survivors, not Congress, and that they should be acting more to ensure there are more prosecutions of people related to Jeffrey Epstein's crimes. We've also heard from survivors. So one group of survivors, which included the family of Virginia Giuffre, gave a statement to BBC Newsnight. And they say that survivors have already shown extraordinary courage by coming forward, and that Melania Trump asking more of them now is a sort of deflection of responsibility, and that it feels like she's shifting the burden onto survivors to speak out, that it's time for those in power to do more, to hold acquaintances and people who have helped Jeffrey Epstein to account.
Simi Jolo Osho in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
It is now 17 minutes past six. Let's turn to the business news. Will Bain is with us. And for once, Will, we are not talking about the impact of the war, are we? You've been talking to a man responsible for turning around that big name restaurant chain, TGI Fridays.
We will, unfortunately, spoiler alert, be talking about the war. Morning to you and Anna, yes, because we'll be looking at oil prices as well. A little subdued coming up, and still investors clearly very nervous about those talks you were talking to Hugo Bashega about. But yes, TGI Fridays has been one of the staples, hasn't it, of many of our town and city centres since its heyday in the 1990s, serving up burgers, ribs, wings, all those kind of things. But under successive ownerships, the chain, amidst that wider slowdown in casual dining, had struggled. Now Ray Blanchette, a former CEO who started his career in TGI's kitchens, has used his family's Sugarloaf Holdings to buy the UK restaurants. 33 they've retained, closed 16 at a cost of around 456 jobs. And he told us about the difficult backdrop to those decisions and his turnaround plans for the chain from his home in Dallas, Texas.
The last several years have been extremely challenged. I just believe that with the right leadership, taking great care of our team members, creating jobs that they're proud to have, it's likely to come back very, very strong.
You told a story, I guess, of the wreckage that you found, fridges turned off, all this kind of stuff. Could you believe the state it was in?
No, that was unnerving because we're a brand that's been built on standards, right? We have the highest training standards and the food safety standards. And so when you walk in and see the business in disrepair, that's when we decided as a management team, maybe it's time for us to step in.
Right. Rather than step away, we moved.
No. It's too important of a business. We can't step away. And what convinced me, Will, is Phil Broad, the president of Fridays, and I, we were driving around the UK. I think we drove sort of 800 or 900 miles in 2 or 3 days, just visiting restaurants. And you could see the team members sort of hanging on to the old culture by their fingernails. And when I saw that the culture was still there and they still want to take great care of their guests, they wanted to serve food that they were proud of, they wanted to sell experiences that they were proud of and celebrate people in the way they were accustomed to, that's really what kind of gave me the courage. I thought, we still have the base here. We can build off of this.
How do you build on that?
In some areas, you sort of look back and go, what are those things that we've always done that are still relevant to today around how we recognize our team members, celebrate them doing things right rather than try and catch them doing things wrong? We believe that the guest experience will never exceed the team member experience. So we kind of put our teams first so that they will then go out and put the guests first. I mean, the way you treat your team members is the way they're going to treat the guests is what we believe. And so I thought if we do that and we bring that culture back, I mean, those are the things that we're known for. And obviously, we know how to throw a party, right? We know how to celebrate those meaningful milestones in people's lives. And when you look at who the customer is today, they may have celebrated their 7th or 8th birthday with us. And now they have 7 or 8 year olds. So we have a whole new generation that's coming into TGI Fridays, and we want to be there to help them celebrate.
How nerve-wracking then, Ray, to do that in the backdrop with here in the UK. I mean, John Vincent runs the Lyon restaurants. He said in the Times newspaper, restaurants are done, restaurants are dead, and that the government is killing them. Can you run restaurants against the current backdrop of the business landscape set out from a sort of government tax perspective?
It's incredibly challenging right now, but I'm bullish in that we're a major employer in the UK. We create jobs that matter. We serve communities. And when a restaurant builds in a community, it lifts everybody up. I mean, it's from the guy delivering produce, the construction worker that builds the restaurant. I mean, every part of an economy is touched when you have a vibrant restaurant industry that's growing. And so at some point, common sense will prevail. There's no way that a restaurant industry, as large as it is going to go away in the UK.
But when you say common sense prevailing, what does that look like? What needs to happen?
I know as an American right now, saying that, you know, common sense in politics sounds a little foolish, but we've been through cycles like this. Like I said, when you've been in this business for a long time, you've seen the ups and downs.
If there was sort of one thing rather than all the things that you could tinker with, perhaps.
I would like to see a level playing field, especially as it relates to tax. I don't think the pub industry is any different than the restaurant industry. We have the same type of P&L. We essentially serve the public exactly the same way. So I would like to see parity and responsible taxes. I'd much rather see the tax base be predicated on a growing economy.
That's Ray Blanchette there, TGI Friday's new boss here in the UK, discussing how he wants restaurants to be given the same rate relief that pubs were afforded by the government in January. The Treasury says it's reforming business rates to back hospitality with a £4.3 billion support package to limit bill rises, alongside capping corporation tax at 25% and cutting the business rates tax by 5p for high street businesses. Well, let's turn to the financial markets then, because as we were mentioning with Nick there, those talks looming in Pakistan this weekend, the global economy en masse seems to be waiting, doesn't it, to see what happens next, in particular around access to the Strait of Hormuz. And Lindsay James, investment strategist at Quilter, is with us. Morning.
Good morning.
Why don't we start with oil there? Where are we this morning? I was saying looks more sort of slightly subdued rise than we've seen, obviously, in the last few weeks.
Yes, that's right. So it's well off the lows that it hit on Tuesday of around $92 a barrel. It's now back up at around $96 a barrel as investors are really weighing the news that we've had out in the last 24 hours. And some of this is also about the announcements from Saudi Arabia that they have quantified the impact on production, which is down 5% since the onset of this crisis. But they also talked about the capacity on that east-west pipeline, which has been really the pressure valve, if you like, away from the Straits of Hormuz. That was attacked earlier this week, and they've said that that has also seen capacity hit by about 10%. So investors are really factoring in that this could be a longer lasting impact on energy markets. And with that, it's Europe and it's Asia that is most susceptible. So we've seen those markets a little bit weaker in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, I was going to say, move us on to then the wider sweep of what you've been watching and what you'll be watching out for today when trading it going again across equities and commodities as well.
Yes, that's right. So we'll be looking for any more kind of positive language coming out that heading into early next week, there are indications that negotiations between Israel and Lebanon are serious. You know, the language that we've had out in the last 24 hours from Donald Trump, where he asked Israel to low-key it, isn't the sort of thing that's going to convince investors or the Iranians at this stage. So I think that's one important factor. And we'll also be looking at, for example, the flow of shipping through the Straits of Hormuz, if there's any pickup, because so far there has been very little. But I think it's also a reminder of the fact that, you know, this is a pattern emerging this year of shocks to the global economy from geopolitical factors. And it's not the sort of thing you can invest around on a short-term basis. So, you know, we won't necessarily be moving positions around on this, but nevertheless, keeping up with events.
And a quick look at the bond market too for us.
Yes, yeah, so we've seen gilt yields up since the start of the conflict. And that really matters because, of course, this is a benchmark for corporate borrowing costs and also for government borrowing costs. So they're up about 0.4% since the start of the conflict. They were back a little bit in the last couple of days as we started to have a bit more optimism around a ceasefire. But I think, you know, moving over the next few days, like equity markets, just tracking sideways, really, as we wait to see whether this ceasefire can hold. But within equity markets, we've seen about half of the losses through the Middle East crisis period retraced now. But I think to go any further, we're going to have to see sort of real progress in the next few days.
Lindsay, thanks as always for your time. Lindsay James, their investment strategist at Quilter. Well, those concerns around what happens next with the war in Iran have also added to the Governor of the Bank of England's concerns about what's going on in the private credit market, apparently. Douglas McNeill, former chief economic advisor to Rishi Sunak when he was the Prime Minister, is with us. Douglas, morning.
Good morning.
So what's the Governor concerned about here?
Well, we're talking here about the non-bank lending market, sometimes called the shadow banking market. It's an arena where companies go to borrow money from entities that are not banks. And we're talking here really about hedge funds these days. And the advocates of this arrangement say that companies can get better service from these non-bank lenders, more responsive, more tailored to their needs. But regulators like Andrew Bailey worry that, in fact, they are going to this market because they are not very good credit risks. The banks wouldn't lend to them in the first place. And they worry also that the people who are doing the lending are less experienced than banks, less good at judging credit risk than banks. And therefore, you have a potentially combustible mixture in which defaults might happen.
Yeah. And the fear that that could then snowball into the kind of wider economy, too.
That's right. So, for example, we saw a big case in the US about 6 months ago where a big company called First Brands collapsed. It had been a big borrower in this market. And as a result of that, we've seen a number of these big funds, these big private credit funds, gate their funds. In other words, the underlying investors in those funds, who might be retail individuals, they might be financial institutions, they are not allowed to take their money or all of their money out in the way that they normally would be able to. And of course, if people can't get their hands on their money, then they may find that they're unable to service all their obligations that they had earmarked that money for. And that can lead to a ripple effect.
And your assessment then, of both the risk and then the responses perhaps needed?
Well, I'm heartened that the regulators are certainly well on top of this. Andrew Bailey is one example of that. The Bank of England has recently run a big stress test of the sort that it used to do just for banks, but it's extended that to the non-bank sector just to try and understand where all the risks are. Other people, Jamie Dimon, for example, the chief executive of JP Morgan, have also been very vocal about the potential risks here. So it's a known issue, and I think we can derive comfort from the fact that the regulators are paying attention attention to it. But of course, regulators are not omniscient. They don't have perfect foresight.
Well, and if the war is exacerbating it, as Andrew Bailey says, exacerbating the problem.
Yes, that's right. And sometimes you find that these things, you know, there's a sort of structure to them. You have a real shock, in this case, an energy price shock, and that translates into a response by policymakers, which might be to do with fiscal policy or higher interest rates, for example. And then that reverberates into the financial system. Prices move and participants in the system have to cope with those moves.
Something
and sometimes we find that some people cannot cope in the way that you would hope.
Something
and that's when problems can occur.
Something we'll return to, I'm sure, as a result. Douglas McNeil, thanks so much for your time.
Will, thank you very much indeed. 29 minutes past six, time for the sport. Mike Williams is here. Morning.
Hello, Anna. Good morning. It is early days at Augusta, but whisper it, the defending champion has made a very good start at the Masters.
McIlroy, 5 under par. What a start to the defence of his Masters title. Rory McIlroy really got it going on the back nine, consecutive birdies at the 13th, 14th and 15th. He will be absolutely delighted with that. It's not happened that for him too often here at Augusta National, getting off to a flyer, but he could not have asked for any more than that.
Yes, Rory McIlroy shares the first round lead at the Masters alongside the American Sam Burns. The defending champion rallied from a shaky start to card a 5 under par 67 at Augusta.
Having won last year, I think it makes it easier to handle difficult situations on the course here. So, you know, I didn't panic. I didn't overreact whenever I couldn't hit a fairway. I just kept swinging and then thankfully started to swing it a little bit better for the sort of the last 10 and a half holes.
Well, McIlroy was among only 16 players in the 91-man field to finish under par on day one. Elsewhere, Justin Rose is 3 shots back on 2 under par alongside Irishman Shane Lowry. Matt Fitzpatrick, a further shot behind on 1 under. So a great start for Rory. Can he keep it up? The second round getting underway later on today. You can follow that on the BBC Sport website with commentary on BBC Sounds this evening from 8 p.m. Next to football and a good night for Aston Villa in Italy.
Corner to be swung in by Aston Villa. Oh, it hit Watkins and it's in! The ricochet converted by Ollie Watkins at the second attempt. And he does, late on, restore Aston Villa's 2-goal advantage.
Yes, that man Ollie Watkins scored twice for Aston Villa as they will now take a 3-1 advantage into their home second leg of their Europa League quarter-final tie against Bologna. Meanwhile, a freak 45-yard own goal gifted Nottingham Forest a hopeful route back into their first European semi-final in over 40 years. Basically, the Porto defender overweighted a back pass and left the goalkeeper stranded. It finished 1-1 between Forest and Porto in Portugal ahead of the second leg at the City Ground next week. Whilst Crystal Palace beat Fiorentina 3-0 in the first leg of their UEFA Conference League quarter-final tie at Selhurst Park. One other football line this morning, the Scotland captain Andy Robertson has announced that he will leave Liverpool at the end of this season when his contract expires. The 32-year-old moved to Anfield from Hull City in 2017 and has won 2 Premier League titles and the Champions League during his time on Merseyside. And speaking of Liverpool, it is Ladies' Day today at Aintree. Great day yesterday up on day one of the Grand National Festival. More crowds, even bigger crowd expected later today. Biggest crowd, in fact, for Ladies' Day since 2012. Later, around about 50,000 people heading down to Aintree. And we have 2 tips for you for the races there today. The first at 1:45, number 16, Jazzy Matty. And then at 4:40, our choice is number 12, Zeus Power.
Mike, thank you very much indeed. Let's hear now from Catherine Carr about a new series next week.
About the girls on BBC Radio 4.
You can't really be, like, that confident as a girl.
Part of a special week examining the challenges facing girls and young women in Britain today.
About 12, a man pulled over in his car and catcalled us for wearing skimpy clothes, is what he said.
Girls from across the country talk candidly about everything from school life to health.
The biggest thing in, like, struggling with an eating disorder was actually, like, social media.
About the Girls with me, Catherine Carr, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Next Monday to Friday lunchtime at 1:45.
It's 27 minutes to 7 now. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
President Trump has accused Iran of breaching the ceasefire deal, saying it has done a very poor job of allowing oil tankers to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. Posting on social media, he said the current situation was not the agreement, and he warned Tehran against charging transit fees. Israel has continued to strike the Iran-backed group Hezbollah in Lebanon, and rockets were fired into Israel in reply, creating tension ahead of peace talks in Pakistan this weekend. Sir Keir Starmer has discussed the conflict with President Trump during his visit to the Gulf. Downing Street says the two leaders agreed on the need for a practical plan to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Writing in The Guardian, the Prime Minister said how the UK emerges from the conflict will define the country for a generation, adding that the war in Iran must become a line in the sand. Survivors of Jeffrey Epstein have accused the US First Lady, Melania Trump, of shifting the burden onto victims after she said they should testify before Congress about their experiences. They said asking more of them was a deflection of responsibility, not justice. Mrs. Trump used a rare appearance at the White House to deny any links to Epstein, describing claims circulating online as defamatory. Russia and Ukraine say they will observe a brief ceasefire over the Orthodox Easter weekend. President Putin said he had ordered a 32-hour pause in fighting from tomorrow afternoon. President Zelensky responded by saying Ukraine had proposed the ceasefire and would act accordingly. NASA has said there will be anxious moments as the Artemis II crew re-enters Earth's atmosphere tonight at speeds of around 25,000 miles an hour. Officials say they have full confidence in the four astronauts on board the spacecraft Orion. They're making final preparations to splash down off the coast of California.
Thank you, Jane. It's 25 to 7. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has instructed members of his government to open direct negotiations with Lebanon, in his words, as soon as possible. Lebanon's president has been asking for talks since the early days of the war. Daniel De Simone is our correspondent in Jerusalem. Daniel will also talk in a second about that news that President Trump says the ceasefire in Iran is being breached because the Strait of Hormuz is not open as he expected it to be just yet. But on that point about talks between Israel and Lebanon, direct talks, enormously unusual, no diplomatic relationship between those two warring countries.
It's highly unusual. They're due to start next week. It's at an ambassadorial level, it seems to be, so not at leader-to-leader level at this stage. Israel saying that Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, yesterday saying he's instructed his cabinet to start these talks. Israel saying there is no ceasefire, though, and that they're going to carry on striking Hezbollah. We obviously saw huge Israeli airstrikes in Lebanon on Wednesday, which killed over 300 people. Lebanon's government has taken steps against Hezbollah this year. It declared Hezbollah's military actions in Lebanon to be illegal. The issue is about disarming them and actually practically making Hezbollah unable to carry on as it had. And that seems to be the focus of these talks, according to what Israel is saying. I mean, Lebanon's president has released remarks yesterday saying that basically the only way the only solution to the situation Lebanon is experiencing is through a ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon, followed by direct negotiations. As we can see at the moment, there is no ceasefire according to Israel. And this all comes in the context of the Iran ceasefire deal, because Pakistan, which mediated deal, Iran both saying Lebanon was meant to be included, Israel and the US saying it isn't included. And that's clearly a huge issue ahead of these planned peace talks in Pakistan this weekend.
Yeah, we're going to hear from Pakistan in just a second. And on that point about President Trump saying that the Strait of Hormuz is not open as expected, what has he had to say? Because as you said there, the Lebanon issue as well, it all makes this ceasefire a very fragile one at the moment.
Extremely fragile. And President Trump has been on his Truth Social platform late last night, US time, series of posts. He is saying that the reports are indicating that Iran is charging shipping fees, and he's saying that can't be. And he's saying Iran is doing a very poor job. He says some would say a dishonourable job of how it's handling the Strait of Hormuz issue. And that isn't the agreement he had. The Iran's new supreme leader, Mujtaba Hamenei, has also been had a statement read out on state TV last night in Iran. He still hasn't been seen since taking over the role from his father, who was killed. And he was talking about keeping the right to seek retribution against the US in Israel. And he's making comments which are widely seen as also talking about Lebanon, because he's saying having the right to seek retribution for attacks on Iran's allies. And that's widely seen as a reference to Lebanon. So absolutely, this ceasefire deal is incredibly fragile going into these talks, which are due to start this weekend.
Daniel De Simone in Jerusalem, thank you.
Let's turn now at 21 minutes to 7 to Islamabad, where those talks are meant to take place between representatives of the United States and Iran. Our news correspondent in Pakistan is Carrie Davis. Good morning to you, Carrie. Against that rather bleak backdrop, are the Pakistani authorities still hopeful that the talks will A, take place and B, make progress?
So at the moment, the messaging is very much that the talks will be happening, and the preparations are all underway here in Islamabad. So the roads are closed off around the red zone, which is where many of the government buildings are and foreign embassies. There are paramilitary, military police on the streets, all securing the city. And we're seeing, obviously, foreign journalists arrive in from abroad too. So there are a lot of preparations underway here in Pakistan. But of course, at the moment, we're hearing from different sources, sort of messaging suggesting that because of these accusations of violations on both sides, does that mean that everybody will come in and have a seat at the table? We heard yesterday from Iran's ambassador to Pakistan, who put out a post on X saying that the delegation would be arriving yesterday evening. That post was then deleted within an hour. And at the moment, we have not had any formal confirmation of any delegation's arrivals. You would have thought that they would have some form of messaging. There might be images on Pakistan TV, that there would be posts from government ministers welcoming the arrival of these high-level guests. None of that has happened as yet. So it could be that they haven't arrived. It could be that this is all being kept under wraps. It could be that they are arriving later on. But we're not being given an idea about exactly what is happening with those delegations. We've also not been given a formal schedule yet of these talks. Initially, Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif had announced that they were hosting these on Friday, today. But we then heard from the White House that the talks would be taking place on Saturday. So there is still time for the delegations to arrive if the talks are happening on Saturday. Everybody here is simply waiting and watching the skies to see who comes in.
Kerry Davis in Islamabad. Thank you.
19 minutes to 7 to Westminster, but on a similar theme, because the Prime Minister has written in this morning's Guardian that he aims to forge a new path towards a Britain that is not at the mercy of events abroad. Learn this from the war. Shocks will come. We must be ready, is the headline in the print edition of the paper. Damien Grammaticus is our political correspondent. Damien, tell us a little more about what he's saying, what he's hoping to manage to do here.
Morning, Anna. Yes. Well, so the Prime Minister, on his tour at the minute of Middle East Gulf states, writing this article, and basically he's linking events in the Middle East to both his domestic agenda that's already being enacted here and which he says needs to be the priority in future. So he does talk about this fact. He says that we've been, the UK, been buffeted by crises from the financial crisis to Ukraine and COVID. But this one shows that the government or the country does need to build resilience to emerge from this, he says, in a way that will define us for a generation. So he talks about the need to invest in homegrown energy, he says, to free us from the tyrants who manipulate gas prices. He talks about rebuilding European alliances, boosting defence capacity, and says that that's the path he wants to forge for Britain. Those, of course, all are things the government is doing and are things that imply policy choices. Now, interestingly, you know, from the opposition parties, you hear criticism already of that from the Conservatives, Reform UK, both saying that if you seek energy independence, you should be doing more to tap domestic energy sources in the North Sea. From the Liberal Democrats and the Greens, more supportive, but both of them, the Liberal Democrats saying you can't trust a Trump-led America anymore. We should be doing more to rebuild ties with our allies in Europe. And the Greens saying we cannot rely on the US for security. We need European security partnerships. but also when it comes to energy and ending fossil fuel dependence. Words are not a plan. We must do much more and not tinker at the edges.
I suppose, for some, a little more detail would be useful, because it's quite broad brush in terms of how he will achieve something which is really quite complicated, to both politically and from an infrastructure perspective, insulate oneself in this global world that we're in.
Yes, and you could also say that the fact he is now touring Gulf states, meeting Gulf leaders in Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, Qatar today, indicates that we are still hugely reliant and connected to the Gulf and the Middle East, primarily because of energy as well. Now, the things that he's talking about in this article, investing in homegrown energy, European alliances, boosting defence, are things, I was saying, that his government is doing. But this would imply more focus on that and more perhaps expenditure on things like defence. And that implies difficult domestic political choices.
It does. Damien Grammaticus from Westminster, thank you.
It's coming up to a quarter to seven now. If you think of filling up that bird feeder in your garden with seeds and nuts to help the birds cope with the summer, don't. Don't feed them. That is at least the advice now of the country's biggest bird charity, the RSPB, which is tearing up established convention on how to feed the birds in our garden, warning that those bird feeders can help spread dangerous diseases amongst garden regulars. And with more than half of UK households feeding birds, the shift could affect millions of us. Our climate editor, Justin Rowlett, has been finding out what's behind the charity's change of heart.
Who doesn't love garden birds? More than 16 million households are reckoned to regularly put out food for them. The RSPB used to encourage it, saying it was good for both the birds and for our mental health, helping connect us with nature. But the advice is changing. Hey Helen,
hi,
Justin
hello.
Here. I see you've got some bird feeders out here.
Fat balls and suet balls. And
then Helen Rowe of the Isle of Dogs in London contacted BBC Your Voice to ask how she can continue to feed birds safely.
I don't want to do anything that's going to spread disease.
The big issue is a nasty disease called trichomoniasis. It's caused by a parasite that infects birds' mouths and throats, making it difficult for them to eat, drink or breathe. It is spread in saliva and droppings. The RSPB warns a single infected bird can turn a busy feeder into a potential hotspot for infection. And the summer and autumn months, when chicks are being fed and the parasite can survive for longer, pose the highest risk. Worst hit are greenfinches. We've lost an estimated 2 million of them in the UK since the disease broke out some 20 years ago. Chaffinches and bullfinches have been hit hard too. And we put out a huge amount of food. UK households are thought to spend £380 million buying more than 150,000 tonnes of bird food each year. Researchers say that's enough to feed the entire population of the 10 commonest garden birds three times over.
Well, there's a male over that direction.
And all that food has an impact on bird populations too, says zoologist Dr. Jack Shutt of Cambridge University.
I went through nearly 1,000 different bird poos and looking at the DNA that was contained within them.
It showed that blue tits, even in some of the most remote parts of Scotland, were eating peanuts, seeds and suet from bird feeders. That's good for the blue tits, not so good for the birds that don't eat at feeders.
So species that compete with blue tits are potentially losing out. So willow tits create their own nests by burrowing into dead wood. And we know that blue tits are dominant to willow tits, so then if there's a lot of them around, they come and they kick the willow tits out.
They evict them.
They evict them, yeah.
They are the UK's fastest declining bird species. So what can be done?
So one of the things that has caused a problem for some birds...
Back at the Isle of Dogs, Martin Fairley of the RSPB is explaining the changes to Helen and her 11-year-old daughter, Elizabeth.
You take the feeder
part.
It has long advised regular washing of feeders.
We can either use a brush or we can just leave it in there to disinfect.
Now it's saying stop feeding seeds and nuts completely between the 1st of May and the end of October, and water should be changed every day.
But it's still okay to feed a bit of protein, and you can do that in the form of fat balls or suet or a few mealworms, just putting out enough to last a day or two.
The RSPB recognises lots of people love seeing birds in their gardens and will be reluctant to change their feeding habits. But it says the evidence of harm is now so strong that, in its words, change is needed. We cannot continue as usual.
Justin Rowlatt reporting there, and we're going to be talking to the boss of the RSPB in around an hour's time.
It's 11 minutes to 7. The end of stamping passports at EU borders should be today, with its digital entry-exit system expected to be running at all Schengen area frontiers. It has been, though, a tricky start, and not every EU member country is ready for this. Simon Calder joins us, travel correspondent at The Independent. You, Simon, as we might expect, have been keeping a beady eye on this. So what is going to happen today?
Well, the EU entry-exit system claimed to be the most modern digital border management system in the world is from today supposed to be 100%. And that means that if you are, like British travellers, a third country national, when you cross a Schengen area border, and of course that's the EU minus Ireland, but plus Switzerland, Iceland and Norway, you should, on the first time you cross, have your four fingerprints of your right hand taken along with a facial biometric. Every subsequent crossing, it should be just your facial biometric. All that information gets put into a central database, and the EU says it's going to make borders more secure, identify overstayers, and actually speed things up. I'm afraid, Anna, that is not exactly happening.
Yes. And so the inevitable next question, Simon, for all of the reasons why this might be happening, is people want to know what happens to me when I'm flying, when I'm getting on the ferry, if I'm going on holiday, working, whatever. What do I need to know? What do I need to think about? What problems might I face?
Well, in short, just do what you're told and hope for the best. But let's start with the Port of Dover, the Eurotunnel terminal at Folkestone and London St Pancras International hub for those Eurostar trains. At enormous expense, including £10 million of UK government money, they have installed rows and rows of those entry-exit system kiosks. They look a bit like overgrown Daleks. You put your passport in, you get your fingerprints tested, checked and everything. Anyway, the total number of people who will be processed by French police going through those kiosks today will be zero, because the system isn't working. It can't get connected properly with the French database, and that has been a massive problem. And so you will simply be processed manually. It might be that you just have your passport details skimmed. It might be that you have your passport stamped, even though we were told that would end from today. And of course, frequent travellers on business or family trips or holiday are finding that their passports are filling up alarmingly. And this whole fiasco, if I may, is going to continue quite possibly until Monday, the 7th of September, which is the next deadline for everything being finished. And coincidentally, of course, that's the end of the summer holidays for many people, when hopefully things will be back to normal. For no moment, though, all you can do is just hope for the best. And look, there are problems getting multiple fingerprinting and photographing as well. I'm hearing that Spain, Greece, Switzerland, Belgium, other countries actually are having problems getting the registration done. So you might think, phew, I've done the fingerprints, don't have to do that again. Oh,
yeah,
yes, you might.
Well, good to be prepared, at least, I suppose. Simon Calder, travel correspondent at The Independent. Thank you.
It's now 8 minutes to seven. 1 minute, Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, insisted there was no ceasefire in Lebanon, and certainly the attacks have carried on overnight. The next, though, he announced direct negotiations with Lebanon, something he'd resisted for a very long time. So what is he up to? Is he trying to help or undermine Donald Trump as he seeks a deal between the United States and Iran? The man who is a a veteran BB watcher, is the Economist Israel correspondent, friend of the programme, Anshul Pfeffer, and he joins us now. Morning to you, Anshul.
Good morning, Nick.
Let's start with that fundamental question. Do you think he wants there to be a ceasefire, or is he rather worried that Donald Trump may be ending this war far too soon from his perspective?
No, I don't think Netanyahu wants a ceasefire at this moment. There's been a lot of criticism here in Israel of Netanyahu, and even from within the right wing, that the war aims have not yet been met. Iran still has the capability to launch missiles at Israel. It did so even after Trump announced the ceasefire on Tuesday. The nuclear program is still there, and the Iranian regime is still there and seems entrenched. So all the war aims that Israel had have not been met. And Trump announced this ceasefire. He notified Netanyahu shortly before he announced it, but Israel wasn't the party to those talks. And then, of course, there's the Lebanon issue. So all these things have been going on, not behind Israel's back, because Israel was aware of all these talks, but Israel hasn't really been part of the talks. And Netanyahu is, I think, hoping that the ceasefire will break down.
Well, let's turn to his decision to say that he wants talks with the Lebanese government. Of course, in a sense, Israel's conflict has never been with the government itself, has it? It's been with Hezbollah and the failure of the Lebanese government, as Israel sees it, to control them, to stop those rockets being fired from Lebanese territory into Israel.
Well, the issue with the Lebanese government not acting against Hezbollah in its own territory, or saying it will act and not finishing the job, certainly not in southern Lebanon, is not a new issue. But when you say this is Netanyahu's decision to hold negotiations with him, there's been the prospect and an opportunity to have negotiations with Lebanese government for a long time. So this is not a sudden decision by Netanyahu. This is once again something that he was prompted to by Donald Trump. Now, in public, Trump has supported Netanyahu, and 2 days ago, when asked, he said, yes, the ceasefire does not cover Lebanon, so backing up Netanyahu's position. But in private, between them, Trump has told Netanyahu that he expects the airstrikes to be dialed down at this point and basically give ceasefire a chance. Hmm.
He used this phrase, didn't he, the president, that Bibi, as he likes to call him, had decided to go low-key in Lebanon.
Yeah, well, that's a very relative thing, but it does seem, since Netanyahu's made his announcement yesterday, that the level of airstrikes has gone down. There still were some Israeli airstrikes against what Israel said were Hezbollah missile launchers, and Hezbollah did launch missiles towards towns in northern Israel. So there isn't yet a ceasefire on that front, but it does seem to be somewhat low-key. And next week, there are scheduled to be meetings between Israeli and Lebanese ambassadors in Washington.
In Israel, what do they make of the fact that Pakistan is hosting the talks between US and Iran? Only yesterday, Pakistan's defense minister issued an extraordinary statement saying that the people who created this, and I'm quoting him, cancerous state on Palestinian land, he means Israel, would, and I quote, burn in hell.
Well, the fact that Pakistan is now a main player to these talks is exactly what Israel was worried about. There was concern of a Turkey being also the main mediator. I mean, these are countries with which Israel doesn't have good relations, or in the case of Pakistan, doesn't have relations at all. And once the talks are being hosted by Pakistan, it just shows how Israel is not involved in these talks, which are critical to Israel's security. And once again, this is a sign of how the outcome of the Iran war, assuming the Iran war is over, or this is a stage towards ending the war, is not going according to what Israel wanted it to do.
Anshul Pfeffer of The Economist, thanks for joining us.
Tomorrow afternoon, there is new drama here on Radio 4 based on a true story.
I had to fight, and I had to bring my sisters with me.
Brand new drama from Amelia Bullmore, inspired by real events.
My congregation was under threat of dispersal. We were being betrayed and we were being victimised.
A community of nuns fighting to save their order any way they can.
A nun can't sell a convent.
We can, in theory, with a unanimous vote.
They sold the convent for about 1.3 million euro.
Shirley Henderson stars in A Broken Order on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Tomorrow afternoon at 3.
Well, we had the summer, Ben Ridge. It lasted about 2 days, didn't it?
Yeah, something like that, Nick. It is only April, 26.6 degrees, yes, earlier on this week. But that was extraordinary for this time of year, an extraordinarily high temperature. What we've got now really is just something much more normal. But what that actually means for us, yes, it is something cooler. And we are going to see some rain at times over the weekend, some brisk winds as well. Most of that rain coming in the form of showers, so some sunny spells in between. But today, we've got some heavy and persistent rain that'll be pushing in across the western side of the UK. The further east you are, the greater the chances of staying dry. Let's begin the forecast for today across the southwest of England and Wales. Not a bad start, some sunny spells, but cloud thickening from the west with some outbreaks of rain pushing eastwards as we go through the late morning into the afternoon. For the southeast of England, the Midlands, eastern England, northern England, southwest Scotland, some sunny spells in the morning, more cloud during the afternoon. Most places staying dry. Just a little bit of rain getting into western parts. Eastern and northern Scotland, some early showers across Shetland. Otherwise, fine with some sunny spells. A bit more cloud into the afternoon, but it should stay dry. For Northern Ireland, a few sunny spells this morning, but quite a lot of cloud around. And this afternoon, it will turn very, very wet indeed. Some heavy and persistent rain, strong winds, which could touch gale force. Temperatures of 8 to 13 degrees. Stays windy through the weekend. Sunshine and heavy showers.
Thank you, Ben. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 10th of April. The headlines this morning: President Trump has accused Iran of failing to live up to the ceasefire deal ahead of planned peace talks this weekend. Israel has launched more attacks on Lebanon after saying it wants talks with the country's government. Melania Trump has propelled the Epstein files back into the news by publicly announcing that she did not have a relationship with Mr. Epstein.
Coming up in the next hour, we'll have one of the first interviews with a survivor of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse, giving her reaction to that call by the First Lady for survivors to give evidence to Congress.
What's going to happen next? She wants us to stand there and tell our stories and tell testimony to Congress, but there's no protection in that. Where's the immunity in that?
And ChatGPT maker OpenAI is pausing a multi-billion pound UK data centre project. So what does that mean for the government's pledge to make the UK an AI superpower? We will discuss. Before that, the BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
President Trump has accused Iran of doing a very poor job of allowing oil tankers to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. On social media, Mr. Trump said the current situation was not the agreement. Only a handful of vessels are reported to have passed through the crucial shipping lane. Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon have also exchanged fire overnight, creating tension and showing the weakness of the ceasefire ahead of talks in Pakistan this weekend. President Trump has encouraged Israel to tone down its attacks. From Jerusalem, Daniel De Simone reports.
Israel said it had struck Hezbollah rocket launchers in Lebanon overnight, with the Iran-backed group saying it had fired rockets at several places in Israel. The fighting comes after President Trump was quoted as saying Israel would be more low-key in Lebanon, comments widely seen as him asking Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to be more restrained. Israel's assault on Lebanon on Wednesday killed more than 300 people. Mr. Trump, in late-night social media posts, said Iran was failing to keep to the ceasefire agreement by doing a very poor job of letting oil through the Strait of Hormuz. Some would say Iran was being dishonourable, he added, and warned Tehran against charging ships transit fees. In a statement read on Iranian state TV, the country's supreme leader, Mujtaba Hamanai, was quoted saying he reserved the right to retribution for US-Israeli attacks on his country and its allies, implying Hezbollah in Lebanon, which Israel and the US claims isn't covered by the ceasefire.
Benjamin Netanyahu has said there's no ceasefire in Lebanon, but has agreed to talks with the Lebanese government on ending the war with Hezbollah. Beirut has asked for Israel to stop its attacks before any discussions take place, but Israeli officials have refused. Mr. Netanyahu says talks in Washington next week will focus on how to disarm Hezbollah. From Beirut, Lina Sinjab reports.
Lebanon continues to look for its dead as Israel pounds the country with more airstrikes. Here, there is no sign of a ceasefire, despite repeated calls for it by the government. The Israeli Prime Minister finally responded to Lebanese President Joseph Aoun's calls for direct talks and said they would start soon. But his army goes on striking the south and ordering the evacuation of big swathes in southern Beirut. Thousands spend the night on the road fleeing imminent strikes. Rescue workers are still looking for survivors under rubble, while hospitals have called on people to come and identify dead bodies. Lebanon's prime minister has said his country will complain to the UN about Israel violating the ceasefire, though Hezbollah supporters have called him a traitor.
Sir Keir Starmer has spoken to President Trump about the Middle East war during his trip to the Gulf. Downing Street says in a phone call from Qatar last night, the Prime Minister set out the discussions he'd had with Gulf leaders and that he and Mr. Trump spoke about the need for a practical plan to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Sir Keir has written a newspaper article saying the way the UK emerges from the war in the Middle East will define the country for a generation. Our political correspondent Jack Fenwick reports.
Writing in The Guardian, the Prime Minister said the war in Iran must become a line in the sand. He said previous governments had been found wanting when dealing with global crises and pledged to make the country more resilient. Sir Keir said the world was volatile and that Britain needed to prepare for more frequent economic shocks. Those preparations won't come cheap, and ministers know that means potentially difficult decisions on spending elsewhere. Speaking in the Gulf region yesterday, Sir Keir said he was fed up of families' bills going up because of the actions of Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. The Conservatives and Reform called on the government to increase energy security by drilling in the North Sea. The Liberal Democrats and Greens said the UK couldn't rely on America and should pursue closer ties with Europe.
Survivors of the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein have accused Melania Trump of shifting the burden onto victims after she said they should testify under oath before Congress. In a statement, they said survivors had already shown extraordinary courage by coming forward. Earlier, the US First Lady used a rare appearance at the White House to deny any links to Epstein, describing claims circulating online as defamatory. Our North America correspondent Simi Jola Osho reports.
Melania Trump's public denial of any connection to Jeffrey Epstein has drawn widespread attention and surprise. In a rare televised statement, Mrs. Trump dismissed claims that she had been a victim of Epstein or that he had introduced her to Donald Trump. She described the allegations as mean-spirited attempts to defame her, urged the public to be cautious about what they believe, and said she had never set foot on his private island or his plane. The question, why Melania Trump chose to make the statement in public now, remains a mystery. Mrs. Trump also called for survivors of Jeffrey Epstein to be given the opportunity to testify under oath before Congress. In a statement, one group of survivors described that suggestion as a deflection of responsibility and said it was up to those in power to act, not victims. Some members of Congress said it was her husband's cabinet in particular who needed to do better by survivors and called for more Epstein-related prosecutions.
Russia and Ukraine say they will observe a brief ceasefire to coincide with the Orthodox Easter holiday this weekend. President Putin said he had ordered troops to observe a 32-hour pause in fighting from tomorrow afternoon. President Zelensky responded by saying Ukraine had proposed the ceasefire and would act accordingly. The RSPB has changed its advice to millions of people who feed birds in their gardens. It's asking them to stop putting out seeds and peanuts from May until the end of October to try to slow the spread of a disease which has caused sharp declines in the number of some species, especially greenfinches and chaffinches. Our climate editor Justin Rowlatt explains.
The RSPB wants to try to stop the spread of trichomoniasis. The disease is caused by a parasite which affects birds' mouths and throats, making it difficult for them to eat, drink or breathe. It's spread in saliva and droppings, and the charity warns a single infected bird can turn a busy feeder into a potential hotspot for infection. It's urging people to stop putting out seed or peanut feeders during the warmer months and says water supplies should now be changed every day. Small amounts of mealworms or fat balls can still be offered. The advice is unlikely to be popular with those who enjoy seeing birds up close, but the RSPB says it follows years of weighing up the benefits of bird feeding against the growing evidence of the harm caused by the disease.
The American rapper and producer Afrika Bambaataa, who was a pioneer of hip-hop culture, has died at the age of 68. He was born Lance Taylor in New York and was best known for his 1982 hit Planet Rock, which combined rap with electronic music. He went on to work with artists including John Lydon and James Brown, but later faced multiple allegations of child sexual abuse. NASA has said there will be anxious moments as the Artemis II crew re-enters Earth's atmosphere tonight at speeds of around 25,000 miles an hour. Officials say they have full confidence in the four astronauts on board the spacecraft Orion, which will splash down off the coast of California. Brian Petrie is the mayor of Ingersoll, the small Canadian town which is home to one of the astronauts, Jeremy Hansen. He says the whole community has been following the mission.
It's unbelievable to a lot of us that, you know, this is happening. He's been working on it for a long time, but it's just happiness all the way around that someone from our town is really achieving their dreams, not only for this town, but for Canada. And, you know, when I woke up this morning, I looked out my back window and the moon looks a little bit different now. And I think that's I think everybody in town will feel that. You know, when you look up there, you can see that there's a piece of Ingersoll up there.
The mayor of Ingersoll, Brian Petrie, speaking there.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It is 9 minutes past seven. A ceasefire in return for the opening of the Strait of Hormuz, the global shipping lane. That was meant to be the deal, but is it working? Donald Trump clearly thinks not, declaring that Iran is doing a very poor job, dishonourable, some would say, of allowing oil to go through the Strait of Hormuz. So why aren't ships and tankers moving again? Perhaps it's because of another message from Iran's supreme leader, who declared that we were in a new phase for the management of the Strait of Hormuz. He did not elaborate what he meant by that. Well, a man has to try and make sense of it all to try and get those tankers and those ships moving again is the Secretary General of the International Maritime Organization. That's the UN agency with responsibility for the safety and security of shipping. He's Arsenio Dominguez, and he joins us on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Could you begin by telling us what you think is happening now on the Strait? How much traffic is able to move?
Right now, we're still on very low numbers of daily traffics. Before the conflict, the average of ships transiting the Strait of Hormuz was around 130. The recent days since then, it's normally between five and six ships transiting, sometimes none of them.
And is that because shipping companies, the crews, are still fearful that if they move, they'll be targeted by Iran?
That's correct. And we cannot put the lives of the innocent seafarers at risk, and of course the ships and the cargoes, because that will be detrimental to safety and the environment. And until there's full confirmation the ships will not be used as collateral damage for this conflict, it is not possible to resume the normal operations in the Strait.
Now, we had Iran's deputy foreign minister on the programme yesterday insisting that these are not, as he said, not international waters. He says they're the waters of Iran and Oman, implying that Iran could control them if they wanted to.
The countries in the region, of course, has access to the national waters, the jurisdictional waters. But it's also important to remind everyone that international straits, in accordance to international law, are actually for the use of everyone. And that's why no toll restrictions should be imposed. And it's the reason why, since 1968, the International Maritime Organization adopted a traffic separation scheme in the strait for ships to go in and out, with the assistance and participation of both countries bordering the straits, which is Iran and Oman.
And in return for no money being paid?
That is correct. It's the right of innocent passage and the rights of the freedom of navigation that exists. And that's what we're working on right now.
But of course, in the end, that just gives Tehran the ability to say no, doesn't it? To say we simply refuse to go along with that.
But those are the conversations that we are actually entertaining at the moment, because we have a very good established traffic separation scheme. Iran has announced a new scheme, but without the details. And that's where we're going into the bottom of what exactly this is going to operate. And of course, all those actions can be put forward to the IMO for us to review through the normal process, guarantee that they allow the safe transit of ships and in accordance with international law. We're open to all discussions.
But do you think the authorities in Iran are negotiating in good faith? Because it's been argued that control of the Strait of Hormuz is their strongest weapon in this war. Why on earth would they give it up if not in return for something substantial, probably money, because the Ayatollah, the new Ayatollah, has demanded blood money, as he calls it, compensation for war-related damage.
That, of course, is a discussion in relation to the root causes of this conflict. I need to focus, and IMO will focus, on how we can bring shipping back together. The longer that this is fired and the quicker that the conflict comes to an end, the better opportunities that we have to bring operations back to normal. And throughout the debates that we have had in place, of course, there has been a link between the root causes of this conflict, as well as how shipping has been negatively affected.
And what is the role of the military once you get some sort of agreement? Sir Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, has been leading talks, we're told, in the Gulf and with other allies about how help can be given to ships and tankers moving through the strait. What actually would they do?
Naval escorts have been used in other areas of conflict, most recently in the Red Sea, in order to safeguard or at least assist the vessels. But I've mentioned in the past that this is not a sustainable long-term solution. Now, one of the areas where naval vessels can assist, for example, is at least at the beginning of resumption operations to guarantee additional safety as we move back to normal. The other area that we will need assistance, and this is where countries have expertise, is to make sure that there are not hazards like mines in the region that can actually strike a ship. But in general, what we look for is to a full de-escalation and bring back the security to the strait as it used to be, and not to rely in something like naval escorts that cannot really guarantee 100% of protection of innocent seafarers and merchant ships.
Arsenio Dominguez, Secretary General of the International Maritime Organization, thanks for joining us.
It's just coming round to 7:15. Melania Trump, the US First Lady, has given a surprise statement at the White House distancing herself from the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. She said she wanted to clear her good name over rumours of links between them, and her message to US lawmakers was clear.
I call on Congress to provide the women who have been victimised by Epstein with a public hearing specifically centred around the survivors. Give these victims their opportunity to testify under oath in front of Congress with the power of sworn testimony. Each and every woman should have her day to tell her story in public if she wishes. Then, and only then, we will have the truth.
Well, I've been speaking to Lisa Phillips, who is a survivor of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse. She was a young model when they met, and she's been at the forefront of efforts to hold those who facilitated his crimes to account. She told me about her surprise at the First Lady's intervention.
I mean, we've just been fed up, you know, lately. Just a lot of political theatrics have been going on since September. We get really close and then two steps back. It's been going on like that for, you know, the last few months. And when Pam Bondi, you know, wasn't our attorney general anymore and Todd Blanche took her place, you know, he just threw up his hands and said, you know, nothing here. You know, we're not investigating anything. Can we please move on? So I kind of thought that, okay, well, I guess this is over, you know, who's going to step up and fight for us? And so Melania would have been the last one that I thought would have done so. And so I like to look at it as a little bit of an optimist and say, okay, let's see what she can do and maybe give her a little pressure. I mean, she brought it up. So let's see what you can do.
What did you think about what she had to say?
First of all, I don't normally hear from Melania, and most people don't hear from her with these types of topics, especially when it has to do with the Epstein file. So this is the first time. And I saw her clearly wanting to clear her name and say that she had nothing to do with these people and these files. And you can see that she was really upset about that. And then the second part, I felt like she was taking a stand to say that, you know, something needs to be done here. She was countering what Todd Blanche had said recently, that there's nothing here and no evidence and we're going to move on from these files. And she was countering it and saying, you know, let's bring the survivors here Let's have a public hearing. Let's hear their stories and let's make it on congressional record. So I was like, wait a second. That's kind of a bold move. That's a big statement. I just wasn't sure where that was coming from.
So you feel that actually what she did, obviously, as you say, she did it with a personal motivation that she wanted to clear her own name. But you feel that she did it in support of survivors as well.
Well, that's what she was clearly saying. For me, you can say something, but where... you know, what goes next? What happens next? So if the survivors say, okay, we want to do that, let's work with Congress, will we be able to? I'm not sure if she's aware, but we've already been to the Capitol 3 times and had press hearings. So she was saying, let's have a public press hearing. We've already done that. What's going to happen next? She wants us to stand there and tell our stories and tell a testimony to Congress, but there's no protection in that. Many survivors have NDAs and many are just scared to talk about their abusers. Where's the immunity in that? It's not something that can be easily done. I suggest having a private testimony hearing. I think that would be the smartest thing to do, but a public one is not going to happen.
Mm. And as you say, there is no guarantee that what she's calling for in any way will actually happen.
Exactly. I mean, obviously it could just be some more political theatrics is what we've seen all year. So I wouldn't be surprised for that just to fall by the wayside. But what I would do is I would call her bluff and I would, you know, push her a little bit and say, okay, now that you've said that, what can you do? What can you do to help us? And what can you do to move us along?
The timing is interesting, isn't it? Because the administration, the Trump administration, has, one would say, sought to minimize this being in the news. And certainly right now, with the war in Iran, it's not a moment when the White House, Melania, needed to be talking about this. And it's interesting that she's chosen to bring this back into the spotlight now.
I mean, that's what we want, is it back in the spotlight. So, you know, thank you for that. Also, you would just think that you would announce something like this because something bigger is coming. I mean, I think that's what everyone's speculating, that there's got to be something else that's coming, that she definitely wants her name cleared of all this.
Later this month, the king is coming to make a state visit to the US. Would you want to meet him for a conversation? I realize that the likelihood of that happening is minimal, but is that something that you would want to happen?
We have already sent letters to him and we've already been requesting meetings with him. I'm not quite sure if it's going to happen, but it may happen with Camilla.
Oh, why do you think that Camilla would... you had something back that makes you think that that's a possibility?
Well, she's always been supportive of the survivors and she's taken a stand for us. So I think she would be the more likely person to meet with us. So, I mean, we're hopeful that maybe she will.
Lisa Phillips, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us this morning. Thank you so much.
It's now 7:20. The Prime Minister, who's still in the Gulf, said that he is fed up with the fact that families across the country are seeing their bills go up and down because of the actions, he said, of Putin or Trump across the world. Well, there's a warning this morning that the retailers are really suffering as a result of the lack of consumer confidence. Will can tell us more.
Yeah, absolutely, Nick. You're right. It's all of that, exactly as you say, that's in the backdrop here, it seems, as to why the British Retail Consortium is warning this morning that the Middle East war is already weighing heavily on both retailer and consumer confidence. And despite their latest footfall figures, so how many of us are heading out and about to retail parks or town centres, going up in March, they didn't do as much as they would have expected because it all was about when Easter fell and it should have seen a much bigger boost than it did. Nick Stowe is the chief executive of Monsoon and Accessorize, joins us this morning. Nick, morning.
Good morning.
Previously, Helen Dickinson and the team at the British Retail Consortium have talked about consumer confidence going through the floor. I mean, are you seeing that? Is that something you would recognise?
Yeah, I mean, she's absolutely right. I think confidence has been low for a long time. I didn't think it could go much lower, but it did. But I think in terms of what consumers are actually doing, we saw some pretty good spending in March. Accessorize is our retail business. And I think we were quite pleased. It was much, much better than February. It certainly was helped by the Easter timing. But it does show that, you know, when given a chance, if the sun shines, you do get consumers out there, they're spending. So I think that's encouraging.
Without meaning to pile more doom and gloom on, though, is it not that the issue is, as we were hearing kind of from Arsenio Domingos's interview as well around shipping, that a lot of the pain might still be to come, a lot of the disruption might still be to come?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think it is a very volatile situation. It's hard to know what's going to happen. But I think those confidence figures took a dive in March, and you can understand why. So I think we are going to see that come through probably in April. You know, we're up against a very, very warm April from last year, so that makes it even harder, and the timing of Easter. So I think it's quite hard to judge the track of retail on the month-to-month figures, because they're quite hard to compare. But I think we are worried about the summer.
Well, long term, what does it mean you do? What does it mean the choices that you make are?
Well, look, we've been through shock after shock over the last few years, and I think if it's done anything, it's meant that we've been very, very focused on managing our cost base. We've been very focused on making sure that we've got enough margin in the products. We've been very focused on, you know, getting our inventory buys right. So we've had good practice over the past few years around this.
But it's consolidation rather than growing, isn't it, I suppose, in terms of the bigger economic picture, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a crisis yet, but it's certainly stagnation. And I think, you know, to operate in that kind of environment, we've just got to be good retailers. We've got to have good products. We've got to excite people. There is spend out there. We've just got to, you know, make sure that we're at the front of mind and we've got good stuff for people to buy.
Nick Stowe, the Chief Exec at Monsoon and Accessorize. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Will. 24 minutes past seven. Can the Prime Minister rebuild a Britain that is not at the mercy of events abroad? That is what he said that he will do, writing in this morning's Guardian. Britain has been buffeted by crises for nearly two decades now, he points out, listing things like the 2008 financial crash, Brexit and COVID. Some will argue that the crises go back much further than 20 years. And they also might like a bit more granular detail, perhaps, about how he will achieve some of the aims that his piece lays out. Well, Lord Darroch served as the UK's ambassador to the United States and is a former national security advisor. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
What is your big takeaway from this piece? Because I think a lot of people would agree that what he's arguing for is very sensible, but there seems to be a degree of coded language in there as well.
Yeah, it's very hard, as you say, to disagree with the idea that we want a more secure future, that we want to be more resilient, that we want to be more independent and less reliant on, for example, energy from overseas. So I think most would agree instantly with those objectives. The problem, as you hinted in your introduction, is the granularity, because none of these things come without investment, without money. And, you know, they need quite a lot of money to achieve them. Some of them need to be achieved quite quickly. And with growth as low as it has been for so long in the UK, there just isn't much around for it. As far as the coding, I mean, there is obviously something in this piece in The Guardian that is reflecting that profoundly unpredictable president over the United States and what he is saying about NATO. And partly it reflects just a very turbulent, dangerous world. Look at Ukraine, look at the Middle East, look beyond that at the rise of China. And, you know, there are issues and problems all around us.
It seems that there are two different things to be achieved. One is the political side of things and one is the infrastructure side of things.
Yeah, I agree with that. And again, political side of things, what he's hinting at there is a tilt towards Europe, a pivot towards Europe, perhaps. And at the moment, what the government is proposing is really very, very modest on this. It's less a pivot, more a sort of slight lean towards Europe. And so a lot of us would like to see them be much more ambitious in that area. But on the infrastructure side, whether it is building a lot more alternative energy to make us less reliant on energy from overseas, or building up our defence infrastructure, which is desperately needed, all of that needs money. And that, again, comes back to, can we generate the economic growth to pay for that? So there are really difficult challenges in all this, and at the moment, it's laudable objectives, but we just don't see how we're going to get there.
You've touched on it a little, and you mentioned defence spending there, but if a Prime Minister came to you, Lord Darroch, and said, help me make this happen, what advice would you be giving?
I would have to say that some really difficult choices are involved here. We have promised to get to about 2.5% of defence spending, of GDP on defence spending, by 2027, and about 3% by the end of the next parliamentary term, so by 2034. Germany has promised to get to 3.5% by 2029. If they do that, they will be spending three times as much on defence as we will, which is not at all our self-image. So it means some really difficult choices about how the government spends its money. At the moment, we spend about $55 billion a year on defence, something like $340 billion a year on social security. Now, of course, we have to look after the most vulnerable in our society. But just at first glance, that looks a bit of an unbalance. But these are really tough decisions on just how how you spend your money as a government. And there are going to be losers as well as winners.
Does that make it a difficult sell, particularly with elections coming in Wales and Scotland, local council elections coming in England? When you're looking at, as you say there, difficult decisions on spending, people right now are looking at things like the bins and potholes and very local issues, and they might not want to hear about spending on defence.
Of course they are, and of course we all want good local services, a good national health service, and good education, and so on. But on the other hand, the government has to make the case more effectively, I think, to the British people than it has at the moment about the dangerous world we are living in and about the essential nature of more spending, essential requirement for more spending on defence. And that means a big public campaign and a lot more government talking about this problem to convince people that there is a real risk here if we don't do this.
Lord Darrick, really interesting to hear your insight. Thanks so much.
29 minutes past seven. We can always rely, or we hope we can rely on the sport to cheer us up. And it is again, Mike, isn't it?
Certainly is this morning, Nick. Yes, because Rory's the story. Once again, at the Masters, the defending champion, Rory McIlroy, shares the first round lead at Augusta. A 5-under par 67 has the Northern Irishman in a tie alongside the American Sam Burns at the top of the leaderboard. Let's get some reflections on the opening round now from the BBC's Alistair Bruce Ball.
After a slightly scruffy start to his title defence, Rory McIlroy settled beautifully and played like a man with the burden of golfing history lifted from his shoulders after his famous win here last year. 5-under par for his last 11 holes, and it's given him a share of the lead with America's Sam Burns on a day when the golf course, and particularly the pacey undulating greens, got shinier and trickier to navigate under a burning sun. McIlroy admitted afterwards he was relaxed but could never be complacent at Augusta.
I was nervous, I was anxious, just like I always am in that first tee. You know, the first round of the 16 most important rounds of the year. So yeah, I'm thankful that I felt the same as I always have. I think it would be worrisome if I didn't feel that way, because it definitely still means something to me. So I would say that I didn't hit the ball very well the first seven holes. And sometimes here that would lead me to get tentative and a little guidey, and I kept swinging, just trusting that, you know, I'm going to find it eventually, and, you know, maybe that was a little bit different.
5-under par means a two-shot lead over the rest of the field. Justin Rose is three back after bogeys at the 17th and 18th. He's at 2-under alongside the world number one Scotty Scheffler. England's Tommy Fleetwood and Aaron Rye are both 1-under, and the weather's set fair for the rest of the week, so this will be a classic Masters challenge, needing precision and nerve to find the right spots and then hold the putts on the firm, fast greens.
Yes, fascinating second round awaits us later. You can follow it all on BBC Sounds from 7 p.m. Next, to football and one of the most extraordinary own goals you're ever likely to see.
Yes! Oh, what a goal! That's from 40 yards, a back pass which evades the goalkeeper. What an extraordinary way for Forrest to get back on terms.
Yeah, that simply has to be seen to be believed. You can find it online this morning. A freak 45-yard own goal gifted Nottingham Forest an equaliser in their Europa League quarterfinal first leg with Porto last night. It finished 1-1 in Portugal. Elsewhere, Ollie Watkins scored twice as Aston Villa beat Bologna 3-1 in the first leg of their Europa League quarterfinal, whilst Crystal Palace beat Fiorentina 3-0 at Selhurst Park in the first leg of their Europa Conference League quarterfinal. Speaking of quarterfinals, it is the last date of Rugby League's Challenge Cup this weekend. Matt Newsome looks ahead.
Hull KR's defence of the Challenge Cup continues in front of the BBC cameras as they face York Knights in Saturday's lunchtime quarterfinal. The Robins, despite back-to-back wins, are still smarting from an opening night defeat by the Knights, who have lost the past three. Wigan must back up their derby loss to St Helens with a trip to inform Wakefield in Sunday's televised game. Trinity haven't lost to the Warriors at home since 2022, having proved a bogey team on their own patch. Back-to-back finalists Warrington take on 2023 winners Lee on Saturday evening, while St Helens host Catalan Dragons on Friday night.
Next to boxing, and Tyson Fury says the death of Anthony Joshua's two close friends in a car crash in Nigeria last year was a deciding factor for him to return to the ring. Fury will face the Russian Arslanbek Makhmudov tomorrow in his first fight for 16 months.
There was a couple of defining moments for me that made that decision for me to come back, and one of them was my long-term rival Anthony Joshua's crash over in Nigeria. When I heard that news, it was so sad, and I thought to myself, you know, life's very short, and I've been a big advocate of saying tomorrow's not promised to anybody, but when things like that happen, it certainly certifies that there is no tomorrow, so you've got to live every day like it's your last. And I thought to myself, you know, I've still got love for this game, I know I can still do it, that's why I'm coming back.
Finally, it is Ladies' Day at Aintree today. A fantastic day up there yesterday on the opening day of the Grand National Festival today. 50,000 expected at the famous old course. Got two tips for you. The first at 1:45, number 16, Jazzy Matty. And then in the 4:40, our selection is number 12, Zeus Power.
Thank you, Mike.
The stories we tell.
About the people we know.
And the places we love.
Are not just made here.
They're stories made of here.
If you could go anywhere in the world, where would you go?
Glasgow.
So where are you from then?
The Glens of Antrim.
Lovely part of the world.
Can you just move to Barry? It's well lush.
Hello, love. Welcome to Birmingham.
You'll always be my home.
Made of Belfast.
Liverpool. Cornwall. Glasgow.
Newcastle.
Cardiff.
Made of here.
Because this is our BBC.
Well, what's the weather got in store for us? It's obviously much less warm than it was, but there will be a mostly sunny start in northern and eastern areas. Much of the UK, though, will turn windy and cloudy with rain starting to move in from the west.
You saw that so positively at the start as well.
I tried.
I know, it's good to try. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in London, Anna Foster in Salford, and Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
President Trump has accused Iran of breaching the ceasefire deal, saying it has done a very poor job of allowing oil tankers to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. Posting on social media, he said the current situation was not the agreement, and he warned Tehran against charging transit fees. Israel has continued to strike the Iran-backed group Hezbollah in Lebanon, and rockets were fired into Israel in reply, creating tension ahead of peace talks due to take place in Pakistan this weekend. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said there's no ceasefire in Lebanon, but he has ordered talks with the Lebanese government on ending the war with Hezbollah. Beirut has asked for Israel to stop its attacks before any discussions take place, but Israeli officials have refused. Sir Keir Starmer has discussed the conflict with President Trump. Downing Street says the two leaders agreed on the need for a practical plan to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Writing in The Guardian, the Prime Minister said how the UK emerged from the conflict would define the country for a generation. One of Jeffrey Epstein's survivors, Lisa Phillips, has told this programme that Melania Trump was taking a stand when she suggested people like her should testify before Congress about their experiences. Ms. Phillips described the First Lady's comments as a bold move. Mrs. Trump used a rare appearance at the White House to deny any links to Jeffrey Epstein and called claims circulating online defamatory. Russia and Ukraine say they will observe a brief ceasefire over the Orthodox Easter weekend. President Putin said he had ordered a 32-hour pause in fighting from tomorrow afternoon. President Zelensky responded by saying Ukraine had proposed the ceasefire and would act accordingly. The RSPB has changed its advice to the millions of people who feed birds in their gardens. It's asking them to stop putting out seeds and peanuts from May until the end of October to try to slow the spread of a disease which has caused sharp declines in the numbers of some species, especially greenfinches and chaffinches.
Thank you, Jane. It's just coming round to 23 minutes to 8. Israel has agreed to open direct talks with Lebanon nearly 6 weeks after resuming the war between the two and days after launching a huge series of military strikes across Beirut and the south of the country that killed more than 300 people and coincided with the start of the ceasefire in Iran. Lebanon's president has been calling for negotiations since the conflict began again. It's an unusual move, but the government is struggling to disarm Hezbollah and now also struggling to support its civilian population who are being devastated by Israel's military action. Well, let's speak to Dr. Firas Abiad, who's a former Lebanese health minister, works as a surgeon at the American University of Beirut's Medical Center, and also Nadeem Shahadi, who's a Lebanese economist, worked on the Middle East at various international think tanks, and is a columnist for Arab News. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Dr. Abiad, tell us first of all, because these are areas of Beirut that you know well. What have you been seeing at the medical center, particularly after the attack we talked about 2 days ago?
Well, on Wednesday, we started after the series of raids that happened all over a very short period of time. We started receiving loads of civilian casualties. We received around 70 patients in a matter of 2 hours. A lot of them had severe injuries, crush injuries or penetrating injuries. They were all ages. We had an 8-month-year-old child or infant. And we also had a 90-year-old gentleman who later passed away. And the scenes were really devastating.
And we said that, obviously, you are a former health minister. You were brought in at the time when Lebanon had a technocratic government, and you were brought in as a medic to run the health ministry. But from your time in government, just try and give people an idea of how difficult it is to disarm Hezbollah. It's something the government's been trying to do and failing so far.
Well, the vast majority of the Lebanese do want a peaceful solution to this conflicts that have been raging in the Middle East for a very long period of time. And I think that this government had a lot of support among the population with its attempt to disarm Hezbollah. And indeed, after the last war, for a period of a year and 4 months, there hasn't been any response from the Lebanese side, despite the continued raid from the Israelis. But the problem that the government faces now is when we face these brutal and indiscriminate attacks, when civilian areas are being struck, when apartment buildings are brought down entirely on the people living inside them. It is extremely difficult for the government within that context to focus solely on how to disarm Hezbollah. It had started the steps, whether in the south, whether outlawing the military part of Hezbollah. But I think that, the Israeli actions, are unfortunately creating a very difficult environment. Also, what is creating a very difficult environment for the government are the calls by members of the Israeli government to annex the southern Lebanon and call it part of Greater Israel. That also, within that context, the government would appear extremely in a difficult situation if its sole purpose is to disarm Hezbollah.
That was a statement made by the Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich. Nadeem Shahadi, these talks that I mentioned at the start, extremely unusual. Direct talks don't happen. These aren't happening at the highest level of government. What do you think can be achieved from them?
No, there is a very clear precedent and a very justifiable precedent to these direct talks between the state of Israel and the state of Lebanon. And I'm saying that because these are state-to-state talks that do not include Hezbollah or any militias. So they are official state-to-state talks. The last time they happened was in May 1983. There was an agreement for Israeli complete withdrawal from South Lebanon with ending the state of war between both countries. And this was a sort of replacement of an agreement in 1949, which was abrogated by the Israelis after the 1967 war. So there was the armistice agreements of 1949, which were replaced by the other surrounding countries, like Egypt, Jordan, and Syria in 1974. But Lebanon, there's a vacuum there that needs to be filled.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, obviously, a key part of what's happening now is it's not just the regional players, it's the US that has such a big say here. When they say to Israel, talk to Lebanon, then it happens.
Yes. So the Lebanese government, although weak, can be considered as having support from the US, from France, from the Gulf countries. So it's not as weak as it may look. It has the international support, and it can engage in limited direct talks with a very precise mechanism on the basis of ending the state of war. And it's very important that the disarming of Hezbollah be an internal matter between the government and Hezbollah, that Hezbollah should not be part of these talks, because it would make it an interlocutor and actually empower it. And I agree with His Excellency that Hezbollah derives legitimacy as a resistance the more Israel bombs the country and occupies part of the country.
Nadeem Shahadi and Dr. Firas Abiad, thank you for joining us. We'll speak at 8:10 to Alex Gandler, who is the spokesperson for the Embassy of Israel to the United Kingdom.
8:17 now. Don't feed the birds. At least don't feed them during the summer. That is the rather surprising advice coming from the RSPB, the UK's largest bird charity, which is warning that bird feeders in your garden may actually be hurting, if not killing, popular birds like the greenfinch when they're used during the summer months. Becky Spate is the chief executive of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds and can explain to us why the thinking has changed. Morning to you, Becky. What is it your scientists are concerned about?
Yeah, so we've done this huge evidence review of all the science around the impacts of feeding birds and the spread of disease, because we were particularly concerned about the declines we've seen in greenfinch and in chaffinch, and now we think also in bullfinch, particularly caused by this horrible parasite called trichomoniasis, which people may have seen birds with it. They kind of fluff up, they kind of have regurgitated food around their beaks and heads, and they die from it. It's a horrible way to die. And there is evidence that bird feeders are causing some of the spread of this disease. So we want people to change the way they feed birds. So we think the risk is highest in the summer, between kind of the 1st of May right through till the end of October. So what we're saying is just pause feeding seed and pause feeding peanuts during that period of time, because those are the foods that finches like. But you can carry on feeding mealworms, you can carry on feeding suet year round, and we think the risk is much lower in the winter. So you can feed seed and you can feed nuts through the winter, because that's when it has most benefit. It's when birds most need food.
And the reason some
because
foods
in the summer,
the reason you're recommending some foods and not others is to do with which foods are appealing to the birds that are most likely to catch this infection.
Exactly. It's all risk based. So we're saying if you're kind of feeding finches, then during the winter, there is a far lower risk of the spread of this parasite. It doesn't like the cold weather. So you can feed them seeds and nuts during the winter, but feed them in moderate quantities and really feed them hygienically as well. So we're saying feed seasonally, but also feed safely. So we already say don't use flat feeders where that regurgitated food can gather and spread disease, but use moderate amounts and move your feeders, clean your feeders. And if you're putting out water, put it out every day fresh. That's really important as well.
And hygiene, simply for the obvious reason that that's a way of limiting the spread of this infection, is it?
Yes, absolutely. So when we looked at all the evidence, we could see there were benefits and there were disbenefits, and it's all about just managing the risks around that. And one of the risks was water. The disease survives really well in water. So we're saying if you have to put out water because you don't have a natural source around you, then you should actually change it every day. And tap water is quite good, actually, because it's got a bit of chlorine in it, so you can change it every day.
And for people who are a bit sceptical about this, there's been quite a dramatic fall in the number of greenfinches, haven't there?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So they're now on the red list. So they've fallen by more than 60% since the 1990s. We've lost 2 million birds, we think. So it's been a really horrible decline.
Mm. Well, more advice, I've no doubt, on the RSPB website. Becky Spate, Chief Executive of the charity. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's 13 minutes to eight now.
And it is shortly going to be time for Thought for the Day. But just before we turn to our speaker in the studio this morning, let me just tell you about the fact that coming up, we'll be having a conversation about the implications of the cancellation of a massive AI project for the ambition that Britain will become an AI superpower. Is expensive energy putting paid to that ambition? But let us turn to Thought for the Day. And the speaker with us in the studio this morning for the first time, Mark Vernon, writer, psychotherapist and theologian. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. The strike by resident doctors highlights the severe tensions faced by the National Health Service. The tragedy of the dispute and any disruption experienced by patients is that all sides involved, no doubt, very much want health services to improve. So, as resolution is sought, can this also be a moment to ask again an increasingly pressing question? What exactly is health? The issue often came to the fore when I worked in the NHS. My role was as a psychotherapist in a psychiatric hospital. We worked with older adults who had often suffered for not just years, but decades. Their pain was substantial and entrenched. What could be offered to such folk? What did we mental health professionals think we were doing? There were no easy answers. Suffering is hard. But a light might flicker in the darkness when a patient felt heard. They realised, even momentarily, that there was someone who didn't have any immediate remedy, but did appreciate the depth of their torment. Many doctors will know such moments. There is a glimpse of connection that is potentially healing and powerful. But why? The answer provides a clue to a notion of health that is not only about an absence of symptoms, valuable though that most certainly is. With a patient who feels heard, you together enter a field of existence that is wider than the previously isolated suffering soul knew was possible. A dimension of life, not determined by having solutions, is discovered as a release or expansion. The word health itself recognises the possibility, as it comes from the Old English for whole. Believers in God will recognise that wholeness as an intuition. Our existence as individuals is actually a sharing in the existence of God. We are as many reflections of the one divine light. A shift of perspective, a kind of conversion, is required for this transcendent awareness to become a steady part of life. The difference with this fuller notion of health or wholeness is that you don't privately possess it, let alone control it, but rather it holds you and you might collaborate with it more fully. The NHS will likely continue to struggle with the demands it faces, even as, and perhaps because, remarkable improvements in treatments will continue too. In this context, a cultural and spiritual conversation about the wider nature of health is crucial. Like the patient who feels better because they're heard, a more expansive vision of what health entails, and indeed what it is to live well, will alleviate stresses on us all.
That was Thought for the Day with Mark Vernon, writer, psychotherapist and theologian. It's 9 minutes to eight.
Are high energy costs and government regulations on things like copyright strangling the dream that the UK could become an AI superpower and the hope that investment in the technology could kickstart Britain's stuttering economy? That's the question raised by the news that OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT, has put on hold its plans to build a multi-billion pound data centre a project called Stargate UK. It would have been built as part of a partnership with tech firms NVIDIA and Nscale. Well, joining us to discuss that is a man who knows all about investing in AI, a founding investor in DeepMind and a founder of the company Fetch AI. Humayun Sheikh joins us alongside the Labour MP for Newcastle-upon-Tyne Central and West, who chairs the Science, Innovation and Technology Select Committee, Dame Chi Onwuora. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Mr. Sheikh, first of all, when you read this statement, which is quite diplomatically produced, isn't it, talking about the price of energy and about government regulations, did you shout out, yes, these are big problems?
Yes, of course. I mean, this to me does not come as a surprise at all. I mean, although we're just blaming it on those two things, I think the whole infrastructure around technology, around AI is very immature. And I think this is an expected outcome.
Explain what you mean by immature infrastructure.
There's a lot of political reasons to announce all these deals, all these big deals. Of course, I understand that. And of course, we need to be seen to be investing in AI. But to do that, you actually have to have all the follow-on ecosystem, infrastructure, all the things that go with it to be present. The environment has to be right.
Well, one key part of that is the supply of cheap energy, isn't it? Because these data centres use vast amounts of energy. Given that Britain has some of the highest energy costs in the world, can you see anything in the short run that could be done to subsidise that energy or to cut the price of it in some way?
Very difficult with what the current situation in the world is. But yes, I mean, I think the government needs to prioritise this above everything, because AI is going to be not just part of our daily life, but also part of our defense. I mean, this is not just investing in business, it's also investing in the kind of the defense of the country itself. I mean, it's strategically very important to have AI data centers.
Even if that means subsidizing billion-dollar companies in the United States?
It doesn't have to be billion-dollar companies in the United States. We need to build our own infrastructure. Perhaps we need to own that infrastructure. Understood. That's very important.
And just one last one before I turn to Dame Chi Onwuora about regulation. Now, we've covered the row about whether copyright should be protected. Artists like Elton John, for example, insisting that his work should not be used in AI. Are you or others saying that that is actually slowing down the development of AI in this country?
It's not about protecting people's rights. It's about having a framework and having a framework fast enough so people and companies feel comfortable investing in that infrastructure.
And currently,
currently it's just vague. We need clarity. And I think clarity is the problem, not what we do, what kind of rules we apply.
Well, let me turn then to Dame Chi Onwuora. It's a pretty bleak sound of the prospects for AI, given what we've just heard, isn't it?
No, I think when these announcements were first made as part of the President Trump's state visit back in September, I mean, they might as well have been called the big, beautiful AI deal. I mean, they were very long on ambition and short on detail. And this announcement today is a blow, in as much as the government has rightly, in my view, emphasized innovation, AI, technology as key drivers of economic growth. And wrongly, in my view, our dependency is too great on US investment to drive that innovation and AI. But I do think you also have to understand some of what's going on in the sort of wider AI picture globally, and particularly with OpenAI, which has announced it's going to be halving its global AI investment over the next 4 years from 1.3 trillion to 600 billion. But that necessarily, which is a huge, huge investment, but also a huge reduction in investment.
Are you implying, just so I'm clear, are you implying that they may be blaming the government for some problems in their own business model?
There are certainly some problems in the OpenAI business model. And there are also the energy spike that we've talked about as a consequence of the Iran war is a global energy increase. And whilst I do believe very strongly...
Britain's energy is more expensive than almost any of our competitors. Now, do you, as a Labour MP, as chair of the Science Committee, do you want to say to ministers, you have to move much faster to get cheaper energy in this country?
So the government has already moved to reduce energy costs for energy-intensive industries such as AI. But yes, you're right. We do need to address the energy costs. We are taking steps to do that. What I'm saying is that our energy costs, which are higher, aren't more higher than they were back in September. Understood. When this announcement was made.
Time's a little short, so I just want to get your reaction as well on the suggestion that the protection of copyright, which was lobbied for by many musicians and writers, is actually hampering the development of these AI models.
It's really important, and I think very much we welcome that the government is taking a stronger line on ensuring that our amazing creative industries are protected as part of AI growth in this country. And I think the idea that that OpenAI is only going to invest in jurisdictions which follow its and tech's desires in terms of regulation is going to be a major challenge for them. Mm. We see in the US that there is huge concern about AI. It's one of the two top issues in the midterms coming up in November. And if they're only going to invest in jurisdictions that don't have AI regulation, they're going to have to avoid Texas, Utah, California, and New York.
Yeah, so don't back off. It's clearly your message on that. Dame Chi Onuora, Labour MP, and Humayun Sheikh, thank you very much indeed from the company Fetch AI.
It is 2 minutes to eight. Alex Forsyth is here with details of tonight's Any Questions. Morning, Alex.
Hello, good morning, Anna, and hello from Edinburgh, which is where we will be tonight to discuss all that has happened this week, whether it's international or domestic. And joining me to do just that will be the Secretary of State for Scotland, Douglas Alexander. Stephen Flynn is the SNP's leader at Westminster. Miles Briggs is the Scottish Conservatives' Shadow Cabinet Secretary for Education and Skills. And Gillian Mackay is the co-leader of the Scottish Greens. As ever, we will be live at 8 p.m. here on Radio 4, or catch us whenever it suits you on BBC Sound.
Thank you for that. Ben Rich has got the weather for us.
Thank you very much, Nick. Good morning to you. Not a bad start to the day for most of us. Some sunny spells, but cloud is already thickening out towards the west, and that heralds a change to wetter and windier conditions across western areas later on in the day. Let's start across the southwest of England and Wales. Fair bit of cloud around already. Some sunny spells, but cloud will thicken with some outbreaks of mostly light and patchy rain as we go through the afternoon, turning quite breezy here. For southeast England, for the Midlands, eastern England, all of northern England, and southwest Scotland. Some sunny spells around, and we will hold on to some of those, but more cloud generally developing. Many areas, though, will stay dry. Eastern and northern parts of Scotland should have a largely dry day. A few showers right now across the Northern Isles, but otherwise some spells of sunshine. The best of that will be across Orkney and Shetland this afternoon. For Northern Ireland, well, here we see thickening cloud through the day, some outbreaks of heavy and persistent rain, some poor travelling conditions here later on in the afternoon, winds strengthening, touching gale force around some coasts, and temperatures of 8 to 13 degrees at best.
Thank you, Ben. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 10th of April. The headlines this morning: President Trump has accused Iran of failing to abide by the ceasefire deal by not allowing oil shipments to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. Israel has launched more attacks on Lebanon after saying it wants direct peace talks with the government in Beirut. And Melania Trump has said rumours that she had links to Jeffrey Epstein are mean-spirited and false, and she's urged survivors to speak out about their experiences.
And coming up in the next hour...
We'd been looking for my old base for years.
Where did it go?
Must be an answer, you know?
The mystery of McCartney's missing Hofner base, stolen in 72, found in 2024, and the global hunt to bring the 30-pound violin-shaped icon home. And a new biography of the journalist who broke the news of Edmund Hillary and Sherpa mountaineer Tenzing Norgay reaching the summit of Mount Everest.
I wasn't terribly, not frightfully interested in the fact of climbing Everest. I was thinking always of getting a scoop, as we used to say then, of beating the opposition and getting the news home. That was what interested me.
We'll hear about the extraordinary life of Jan Morris on the day their new biography is released. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
President Trump has accused Iran of doing a very poor job of allowing oil tankers to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. On social media, Mr. Trump said the current situation was not the agreement. Only a handful of vessels are reported to have passed through the crucial shipping lane. Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon have also exchanged fire again overnight, creating tension and showing the weakness of the ceasefire. From Jerusalem, Daniel De Simone reports.
Israel said it had struck Hezbollah rocket launchers in Lebanon overnight, with the Iran-backed group saying it had fired rockets at several places in Israel. The fighting comes after President Trump was quoted as saying Israel would be more low-key in Lebanon, comments widely seen as him asking Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to be more restrained. Israel's assault on Lebanon on Wednesday killed more than 300 people. Mr. Trump, in late-night social media posts, said Iran was failing to keep to the ceasefire agreement by doing a very poor job of letting oil through the Strait of Hormuz. Some would say Iran was being dishonourable, he added, and warned Tehran against charging ships transit fees. In a statement read on Iranian state TV, the country's supreme leader, Mujtaba Hamanai, was quoted saying he reserved the right to retribution for US-Israeli attacks on his country and its allies, implying Hezbollah in Lebanon, which Israel and the US claims isn't covered by the ceasefire.
Sir Keir Starmer, who's still visiting the Middle East, has spoken to President Trump about the war. Downing Street says that in a phone call, the Prime Minister set out the discussions he'd had with Gulf leaders and that he and Mr. Trump spoke about the need for a practical plan to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. The Secretary General of the International Maritime Organization, Arsenio Dominguez, told us that safety needed to be guaranteed so ships could begin using the strait as normal.
We cannot put the lives of the innocent seafarers at risk and, of course, the ships and the cargoes, because that will be detrimental to safety and the environment. And until there's full confirmation that ships will not be used as collateral damage for this conflict, it is not possible to resume the normal operations in the strait.
While disagreements about the fragile ceasefire continue, preparations are underway in Pakistan for talks between US and Iranian officials this weekend. Tensions are high. In a now-deleted social media post, Pakistan's defence minister described Israel as a curse on humanity. The Israelis said such remarks would not be tolerated from a government presenting itself as a neutral mediator. There has been no official confirmation that either delegation has yet arrived in Islamabad. Our correspondent Caroline Davis is there and sent this report.
The roads have been blocked, paramilitary, army and police deployed, and the journalists are arriving. But so far, there is no sign of senior officials. Yesterday, Iran's ambassador to Pakistan posted on social media that their delegation would land that night, but deleted it within an hour. There have been no images on Pakistan media of planes touching down, no messages from ministers welcoming the arrival of high-level guests. Since the talks were announced, Pakistan has remained positive that not only would they happen, but that there is a chance to find meaningful dialogue. This morning, its foreign minister announced that all delegates and journalists from nations participating in the talks, travelling to Islamabad, would be given visas on arrival. No formal schedule has been announced for the talks, but the White House has said that they would be held on Saturday morning. Islamabad is waiting.
Survivors of the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein have accused Melania Trump of shifting the burden onto victims after she said they should testify under oath before Congress. In a statement, they said survivors had already shown extraordinary courage by coming forward. The US First Lady used a rare appearance at the White House to deny any links to Epstein, describing claims circulating online as defamatory. Our North America correspondent Simi Jolyosho reports.
Melania Trump's public denial of any connection to Jeffrey Epstein has drawn widespread attention and surprise. In a rare televised statement, Mrs. Trump dismissed claims that she had been a victim of Epstein or that he had introduced her to Donald Trump. She described the allegations as mean-spirited attempts to defame her, urged the public to be cautious about what they believe, and said she had never set foot on his private island or his plane. The question, why Melania Trump chose to make the statement in public now, remains a mystery. Mrs. Trump also called for survivors of Jeffrey Epstein to be given the opportunity to testify under oath before Congress. In a statement, one group of survivors described that suggestion as a deflection of responsibility and said it was up to those in power to act, not victims.
Lisa Phillips, a survivor of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse, told us she was surprised by Mrs. Trump's statement, particularly in light of recent comments from the acting Attorney General, Todd Blanche, about the Justice Department's investigation into Epstein.
I felt like she was taking a stand to say that, you know, something needs to be done here. She was countering what Todd Blanche had said recently, that there's nothing here and no evidence and we're going to move on from these files. And she was saying, let's bring the survivors here. Let's have a public hearing. Let's hear their stories and let's make it on congressional record. So I was like, wait a second. That's kind of a bold move. That's a big statement.
Russia and Ukraine say they will observe a brief ceasefire to coincide with the Orthodox Easter holiday this weekend. President Putin said he had ordered troops to observe a 32-hour pause in fighting from tomorrow afternoon. President Zelensky responded by saying Ukraine had proposed the ceasefire and would act accordingly. China's President Xi Jinping has held a rare meeting in Beijing with the leader of Taiwan's opposition Kuomintang Party, where both sides stressed the need for peace. Zhang Liwen is the first sitting leader of the party to visit China in almost a decade. Beijing claims Taiwan as part of its territory and has not ruled out using force to achieve its goal of unification. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports.
President Xi told Cheng Liwen that people on both sides of the Taiwan Strait were Chinese and that the vast territory of the motherland cannot be divided or fragmented. Taiwan's ruling party, the DPP, has criticised Ms. Cheng for being subservient to Beijing and claimed her trip was being completely controlled by the Communist Party. China's air and maritime forces regularly conduct military exercises around Taiwan to exert pressure on the democratically elected government, which describes the sorties as harassment and preparation for a possible invasion. This visit comes amid growing scepticism in Taiwan about whether Donald Trump and the US would help defend the island if China decided to invade.
Cleveland police say a child has died in a suspected dog attack. Officers were called to a house in Redcar yesterday afternoon and they say a dog was destroyed at the scene. One person was taken to hospital. It's not known what breed the dog was. The Home Office has announced an increase in the number of specialist police officers on the streets to protect Jewish and other faith communities. It says they're facing a period of increased concern as both anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim hate crime have reached record highs. Here's our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha.
The government says £5 million of new money will be spent immediately on increasing the number of officers deployed as part of Project Suvatar, which aims to disrupt criminal activity and protect communities with both highly visible and undercover patrols. The Home Office says the decision to spend more on the scheme follows attacks on Jewish and Muslim sites. The money will initially be used by forces in London and Manchester. But some from those communities have questioned whether the amount of money is enough to make a real difference when so many are feeling unsafe.
NASA says there will be anxious moments as the Artemis II crew prepares to re-enter Earth's atmosphere tonight at speeds of around 25,000 miles an hour. Officials say they have full confidence in the four astronauts on board the spacecraft Orion, which will splash down off the coast of California. Our science correspondent Palab Ghosh has been following the mission.
In just a few days, Artemis II has taken humans further from Earth than any other mission, and its crew and Orion capsule have been tested in the harsh environment of deep space. Now the crew will be running through checklists for their return home and later suiting up for re-entry at around 1:07 on Saturday morning. Through the eyes and emotions of the astronauts, millions have felt a rare sense of hope, agency and optimism at a time when the planet seemed to need it the most. But as the head of NASA stated before launch, no mission can truly be called a success until its crew are safely back on Earth.
Palab Ghosh reporting.
Thank you, Jane. It's 10 minutes past eight. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has instructed members of his government to open direct negotiations with Lebanon, in his words, as soon as possible. Lebanon's president has been asking for talks since the early days of the war, but now the continuing Israeli military attacks threaten the fragile ceasefire between the US, Israel and Iran, and his request has finally been granted. The Lebanese government has been trying and has so far failed to disarm the military and political group Hezbollah, a key Iranian proxy. It's launched repeated attacks on northern Israel from the south of Lebanon since the conflict began in Iran nearly 6 weeks ago. The Israeli government says it is using military action to destroy Hezbollah's weapons itself. On Wednesday, Israel's military said it struck more than 100 targets in Lebanon in just 10 minutes, hitting Beirut, the Bekaa Valley in the east and the south of the country. Well, that was the sound at a restaurant. On the Corniche at El Masra in Beirut, it is a busy seafront area. In those attacks across the country, 10 minutes of attacks, more than 300 people were killed in those strikes. 33 of them were children, reports UNICEF. Well, Lise Doucette is our chief international correspondent. Lise, it's worth saying that talks between Israel and Lebanon, they simply don't happen. So in itself, it is an important moment. It's what's provoked that that also gives us the other layers of context that we need here.
Good morning, Anna. Well, it would be a very big moment if the sounds we just heard were the sounds of clinking teacups around a negotiating table and not the sounds of a war continuing. As you mentioned, Lebanon had been asking for a long time for Israel to open negotiations. That offer was never accepted. And now, in the midst of a war which seems to intensify by the day in Lebanon, causing civilian casualties as Lebanon's Hezbollah is pounded, it puts the Lebanese government in a very difficult situation. They have accepted the talks. They want the talks. But it weakens their hand when their country is coming under attack. And of course, Lebanon is one front in this very wide multi-front war.
Yeah, which will be discussed in Pakistan, those talks which are expected to happen between Iran and the US. What will be, well, if they get to the negotiating table, Lise, what will be on it?
Well, preparations are underway in Islamabad, we understand. The Americans are preparing, the Pakistanis are preparing. But our listeners will, we hope, have heard yesterday the Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister, Said Khatibzadeh, as speaking to your program, saying that they wouldn't go to the talks until the terms of the ceasefire, as it was announced by the Pakistani mediator, saying that it included all fronts, including Lebanon. Now, there's been no official statement from Iran saying that the talks are off, but some of the news agencies linked to the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, who are calling the shots now in Iran, they're saying the talks are suspended until the Lebanese front is quiet. There's no sense that the talks have been canceled, but it does raise a question mark. But it gives you a sense of, if you can't even agree on the terms of a ceasefire, it highlights just how hard it's going to be when they sit down to discuss the substantive issues on which they remain very, very far apart.
They do. Lise Doucette, thank you, our chief international correspondent. Well, a week ago on this programme, I spoke to the UN's humanitarian chief, Tom Fletcher. He was telling me about the situation in Iran and also the situation in Lebanon, where he'd just been. And he said civilian lives are not being protected and he believes that war crimes are being committed.
This stuff isn't negotiable. You don't hit civilian infrastructure. That includes hospitals across Beirut and across Lebanon. I met huge numbers of medics whose ambulances are being hit at the moment. You don't hit schools. You don't hit energy sources. You don't hit bridges. Those are war crimes. That is absolutely clear in international law.
Well, let's speak to Alex Gander, the spokesperson for the Embassy of Israel to the United Kingdom. Good morning.
Good morning. Shalom.
Tom Fletcher says that it is clear in humanitarian law that civilian infrastructure should not be hit. So why is Israel doing that in Lebanon?
Well, we can talk about what is happening in Lebanon, but it's quite important to put this whole thing in context. Hezbollah is using every possible infrastructure that Lebanon, the state of Lebanon, has in order to conduct attacks on Israeli civilians. That includes houses, includes bridges, includes residential and urban areas. And unfortunately, Tom Fletcher I don't know why he said it the way he said it, but he's completely wrong on every legal level. There are caveats within the international law that explain if civilian infrastructure is used to act as part of an aggressive war, then it becomes a military target. So Tom Fletcher
was wrong.
Not when
so many civilians are being killed. I mean, the attacks on Wednesday killed 33 children, and they are not combatants. And we talked about ambulances, bridges. It is civilian infrastructure. It is clear under international law. So why is Israel doing that?
Well, bridges are used for Hezbollah to reinforce their forces in
They're
the south of
Lebanon.
They're
also used for people to flee. Civilians
Absolutely.
To flee.
Hence, some of the bridges were not hurt and not hit. And
most of them were.
Yes, most of them were. If I'm not mistaken, 6 out of the 8 bridges that connect the north to the south have been hit. And that is to control Hezbollah's reinforcements to the south. Now we know who is crossing which bridge, where before it was much harder. Hezbollah uses ambulances to transport troops. There are videos of that. Hezbollah uses houses to store rockets. There are videos of that published by Hezbollah, by the way, not just Israel.
But that doesn't explain why children are being killed. That doesn't explain why an Israeli airstrike killed an official in the Lebanese forces, a Christian party, an anti-Hezbollah party. These people are not members of Hezbollah. Why are so many civilians being killed in Israeli attacks in Lebanon?
I think we can all agree that no civilian should be killed, ever. Not in a car crash, not in a war, not ever. But unfortunately,
or in an Israeli airstrike.
Not in any situation. Unfortunately, the reality of war is, and especially this war with Hezbollah, that is using Lebanon as a shield and the people of Lebanon as a shield, and using civilian buildings, high rises in Beirut as staging areas, as command centers, as places where they build their underground bunkers. We saw it during the last war as well. If you remember, Hassan Nasrallah was hiding in a bunker under a residential neighborhood and was killed there as well.
Okay, so 6 weeks ago,
how would you act?
The Lebanese government said, look, let's have talks about this. Let's have direct talks. Enormously rare and unusual to have direct talks between Lebanon and Israel. Why has it taken Israel 6 weeks to agree to that?
Well, first of all, it is rare, but not totally rare. We've had direct talks, be it in the last round of fighting we had with Lebanon. And before that, 4 years ago, we did have a direct negotiations regarding maritime borders, which were agreed. We would have loved to have peace with Lebanon and see Lebanon as part of a bigger Middle East, as part of the Abraham Accords, as part of something that brings Lebanon within the fold of peace within the wider Middle East.
So why not include Lebanon in the current ceasefire then? That would do that.
Well, the state of Lebanon has failed to disarm Hezbollah, even though not only has it promised, it also said it delivered on disarming Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon.
The key thing here is it's tried. And you know that it is a weak government in a struggling country, and they have tried. What you could potentially have done, instead of focusing on bombing the south of the country and bombing Beirut, you could have offered to help, because they said, as they said very clearly, we don't want Hezbollah to have these arms. We are trying. The Lebanese armed forces are trying. Would there have been a world in which you could have helped them somehow to achieve the joint aim of both Israel and the Lebanese government?
Let me ask you the question. How do you see this help happening? I don't think that Hezbollah would have, indulged Israel with giving away their weapons to Israel.
Well, no, I meant if Israel had somehow supported the Lebanese armed forces. It was a question. You might think it wouldn't be, but it's an alternative to bombing the country, isn't it? When we talk about these talks as well, and we were speaking to a couple of Lebanese guests earlier, and they both made the point that Bezalel Smotrich, the Israeli finance minister, has talked about the annexation of South Lebanon as one of the aims, the objectives of this war. Is that something that you share as a war aim, the annexation of South Lebanon?
I don't think it was discussed as a possibility within the Israeli government or as part of what Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu talked about regarding this recent talk. So no, it's not.
So why is the finance minister saying it then? Because you can see that it creates a bad climate for negotiations, doesn't it? And he's a key part of that government. So when he talks about calling for the annexation of South Lebanon, the Litani River, he said, must be our new border, just like the yellow line in Gaza. Why are members of your government speaking out of turn like that?
Well, that's something you'll probably need to ask the finance minister. I do speak for the official line of the Israeli government, and that is
and
not
the official line. He's in the government. He's a member of the government. So that's why I'm asking you. Why is he putting forward lines that aren't official government lines when he's a key member of that government?
Because, as you know, in democracies, different parties make different coalitions. And in those parties, the politicians can say their line. But the official line of the Israeli government is not that.
Do you believe that Israel has achieved its aims in the war with Lebanon and in the war with Iran?
Well, we're working towards it. Regarding Lebanon, I think the aims are probably similar to what the Lebanese state now has. And it means disarming Hezbollah and driving away Iranian influence from Iran. I think your Lebanese guests who've spoken have spoken about their wish to drive away Hezbollah and drive away
Iran.
Absolutely,
they did.
So I think we share very similar goals.
So what about the war in Iran? Because the US has drawn that to a close. They've got it's a very fragile ceasefire at the moment. But what about Israel's war aims? I'll ask again, because you know that the Israeli opposition have been very clear that Israel's war aims have not been achieved here. Benjamin Netanyahu has said it's a station along the road. He hasn't really said that its aims have been achieved either. What do you say?
Well, again, the goals were pretty clear at the beginning. Disarmament of Iran from nuclear arms, disarmament of Iran from ballistic missiles that have been shooting towards every country in the Middle East in the last 2 months or month and a half, and creating an opportunity for the Iranian people to maybe have their fate decided by them. So are those goals achieved? Probably not yet. But again, as Prime Minister Netanyahu said, we are on the road to it. There are different ways to achieve it. For years, it has been diplomacy, which has been tried. Now it was Operation Roaring Lion on the Israeli side and Epic Fury from the American side. We'll see what these negotiations will bring and what the American negotiators will be able to discuss with the Iranians in Pakistan.
So based on what you've said there, it's fair to say that President Trump, that the US has called time on this war in Iran before you believe that the objectives have been achieved.
Well, no, that's not what I said.
It is what you said. It is. No. You said that the objectives hadn't been achieved.
Okay, that's not what I said. Anyway, but I think that these negotiations are another avenue that is part of a wider approach regarding this war.
Okay, Alex Gandler, spokesperson for the Embassy of Israel to the United Kingdom. Thank you.
8:24 now. No one, or at least almost no one, was talking about Melania Trump and Jeffrey Epstein. Until, that is, the First Lady surprised the world, and it seems even many in the White House, by making a public statement behind a lectern and in front of the presidential seal, declaring that she wanted to clear her good name over rumours of links between them.
I have never had any knowledge of Epstein's abuse of his victims. I was never involved in any capacity. I was not a participant, was never on Epstein's plane, and never visited his private island. I have never been legally accused or convinced of a crime in connection with Epstein's sex trafficking, abuse of minors, and other repulsive behavior.
I've been speaking to Ed O'Keefe, senior White House correspondent for CBS News, the BBC's partner in the States, and asked him how surprised he and other reporters were by that statement.
Oh, this was a complete stunner. We did not get much heads up at all about what exactly she would be speaking about. There was a message sent out Wednesday evening saying she's going to give some kind of a statement in the afternoon on Thursday. Unclear what it would be. And only minutes before she spoke did producers suddenly get a message from the First Lady's office saying this might be a little more personal than her previous public statements from here at the White House. And that instantly set off a panic in newsrooms that perhaps she was going to reveal a health scare or some decision regarding her marriage with the president. Nobody had any idea. So we were all on standby for some dramatic, unexpected personal announcement. And she comes out, she heads to the lectern, and almost immediately starts talking about Jeffrey Epstein. And we all looked at each other like, Epstein?
Was anybody else talking about her and Epstein at the time?
No. And if you review the emails that have been released by the Justice Department, there's essentially one that signals that she and Ghislaine Maxwell were in communication at one point in a very friendly way that sort of reflects the photos you've seen of her with Maxwell and Epstein and Trump through the years. And as she said in her statement, we were invited to similar parties, given that we were in similar social circles in New York and Palm Beach. But that was it. And then she went on to say, I never had a relationship with him. I knew nothing about the sex trafficking rings that he was running with Ghislaine Maxwell. She and I were not friends. And oh, by the way, the Republican-led Congress, which has gone out of its way over the last several months to make this story go away, should hold hearings starring the victims so that we hear more from them, which was just this huge gift to Democrats who have been trying to keep this alive, knowing full well that so many Americans are still convinced that there's much more to this story that the White House and like-minded Republicans on Capitol Hill have been trying to suppress.
Have we any idea what they make of that in the West Wing of the White House?
All we know is there are some, at least in the West Wing, who were trying to get the First Lady not to discuss this, arguing that there was no report, no forthcoming documentary, no other story that they know of that would have suggested what she was inferring today, that there was some connection and that someone was going to reveal that. Because initially we all thought, is there some big expose about the land that she's trying to get out ahead of? And there doesn't appear to be. And apparently there were attempts made to get her to not do this, arguing that with everything else going on, the war, the state of the economy, the fact that the party itself is quite concerned about the elections in November, there's no need to dredge this up yet again. But apparently she plowed ahead saying, no, I want to talk about this and I want to clear my name. Now, the president was then asked by different outlets as they can reach him to sort of say, did you know anything about this? In one instance, he suggested he didn't. In others, he suggested he did. The West Wing was sending my colleagues essentially the emoji of a shrugging woman going, you know, we didn't know what to make of this. She said it, and we'll see what happens next.
And it's not only the White House where they're shrugging. Even some victims of Epstein are not actually pleased that she wants them to speak out.
There are some who said that. There are others who, of course, have been pushing Congress to hold more hearings starring the victims, to let their voices be heard, to let their stories be put on the record, and to remind the Justice Department that, in their view, they have not released everything that they have at their disposal. So we'll see when Congress returns next week if, amid all the other heady things they have to deal with, they want to suddenly schedule hearings at the behest of the First Lady, who decided to bring this up out of nowhere, certainly unexpectedly, to suggest that this issue is not resolved, in her view.
That was Ed O'Keefe, senior White House correspondent for CBS News, still stunned, really, by what he and others had heard from Melania.
It is 29 minutes past eight. It's time for the sport. Mike's back.
Hello again, Anna. Let's hear quickly, shall we, from Rory McIlroy, the defending Masters champion, shot a 5-under par opening round 67 yesterday to leave him in a share of the lead at Augusta.
I couldn't have asked for much more, especially after the way I started. In the trees on one, in the trees on two, in the trees on five, in the trees on seven. Honestly, I'm even more pleased with the first seven holes, playing those in even par. Then when I started to swing it a bit better, I could string some good holes together, make some birdies. But I definitely relied on my short game and my experience today. And hopefully I hit a few more fairways tomorrow and give myself a few more chances.
Can he stay there, Rory? We will find out later. The second round of the Masters gets underway this afternoon. Follow that on the BBC Sport website and then live on BBC Sounds from 7pm. Football's Europa League next, and Aston Villa will take a 3-1 lead into the second leg of their quarterfinal with Bologna after victory in Italy last night. Nottingham Forest against Porto is level at 1-1, whilst in the Conference League, Crystal Palace are 3-0 up on Fiorentina in the first leg of their quarterfinal. We now, though, are going to talk rugby union because the quarterfinals of the Champions Cup get underway later this evening with an all-English showdown down at the Rec as Bath take on Northampton. Delighted to say we can look ahead to this one with the former Wales wing Alex Cuthbert, who joins us on the programme. Hi, Alex.
Good morning, mate. How's it going?
Yeah, we're all good here. Thank you. So these are the top two sides in the Premiership, aren't they? Bath and Northampton meeting for a place in a European semi-final. How do you see it going?
Yeah, it's going to be an absolute cracker of a game. I think, obviously, I think this season Northampton have actually had the better of Bath. They had a great away win early in the season, taking down a pretty weakened side. But, you know, this is knockout rugby. Bath at home, pretty, you know, they're very hard to beat. Be the first time they've made a semi-final since 2006, I think, so for Bath. So that, you know, that's mad, really. Mad stat to think for a club like Bath. But, yeah, you know, average points, 31 points apiece. So it's going to be a high-scoring game. Yeah. And it's just who can keep the teams out the least, I think. So, yeah, real tough one to call.
28 years since Bath were European champions back in 1998. But they are Premiership champions currently, of course, Alex. And many people thinking, if not now, when? This is one of the best Bath sides we've ever seen. And as you say, with that home advantage under the lights at the Rec, they will really fancy themselves later.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, like you said, they will not have a better chance, albeit they're playing a team like Northampton who are playing very well. They've got some superstars themselves, the likes of obviously Henry Pollock, Finn Smith. So I think that battle at 10 is key. You know, Finn Russell v Finn Smith, real tricky game. But, you know, home advantage in these European competitions, I think if you look back at the whole of the history, only one away team has gone on to win in these sort of quarterfinal games. So All the stats are against Northampton and they're with Bath.
Hopefully be a classic down at the Rec later. And just briefly, Alex, of the other quarterfinals this weekend, what else catches your eye?
I think the one to say is on the Sunday, Toulouse v Bordeaux, absolutely massive game. Not sure who's going to come out on top of that, but like I said, that could be another away win. You know, Toulouse, the control, the structure, Bordeaux, tempo, absolute chaos, unbelievable team to go and watch. So that'll be another exciting one. Glasgow and Toulon, very formed team in Glasgow. They've got another very good shout. They won't have another better opportunity than to get further in this competition than they've ever had before as well.
And then the final quarterfinal is Leinster against Sale tomorrow in the evening. Alex Cuthbert, I know you're part of the BBC's coverage of Bath against Northampton later. You can hear that on BBC Sounds. Many thanks for your time this morning. Just time to leave you with the tips for Ladies' Day at Aintree, the biggest Ladies' Day crowd since 2012 expected later on Merseyside, around about 50,000 people heading down for, I think, what is a mixed day weather-wise. Maybe take the brolly if you are heading down. 1:45, our first tip, number 16, Jazzy Matty. And then at 4:40, we go with number 12, Zeus Power. Of course, tomorrow, this time tomorrow, we'll have two tips for the Grand National for you. The only problem with being at Aintree yesterday, where we were for the programme yesterday, fantastic morning, but everyone has a Grand National tip. So I've come away with about 9 selections for the big race tomorrow. I don't know which one to back. Everyone's certain that their tip is the one. And we'll find out tomorrow, I guess.
Just put the money on the favourite. Okay. It's the easiest thing to do, isn't it?
All the 100-to-1 shot.
Or just a name you like. Yeah, I mean, the joy of the Grand National. Colours of the cap or whatever. Anyway, enjoy. It's one of the treats of the year, isn't it? Thank you for that. This morning after 9, the reunion looks back to the last time the Tartan Army made it to the Men's World Cup. Here's Kirsty Walk.
The record of the Scotland men's football team in the World Cup is unique. 8 tournaments and never once through to the second round. We'll really shake them up when we win the World Cup, rang out the theme song in the 70s. But by 1998, it was simply, don't come home too soon. That was our last time in the World Cup. An epic opener against Brazil, a dressing room snub for Sean Connery and Jackie Stewart, the never-ending strip the willow through the streets of Paris, penalty joy, a noble draw against Norway, and a final skewering by Morocco. Those who were there, that's all of us, reflect, and look forward to this summer when Scotland returns to the World Cup. That's The Reunion, this morning at 9 o'clock.
The weather this morning sees a mostly sunny start for northern and eastern areas, but don't be fooled. Much of the UK will turn windy and cloudy with rain starting to move in from the west.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Nick Robinson in London at 25 to 9. Jane Steele's got a summary of the news.
President Trump has accused Iran of breaching the ceasefire deal, saying it has done a very poor job of allowing oil tankers to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. He said the current situation was not the agreement, further increasing the tension ahead of planned peace talks in Pakistan. The Israeli military has continued to strike the Iran-backed group Hezbollah in Lebanon, and rockets were fired into Israel in reply. Israel has said it will hold talks with Lebanon, but insists the fighting there is not part of the ceasefire. On this programme, Alex Gandler from the Israeli embassy in the UK rejected claims that some of the strikes were war crimes. He said ambulances were used by Hezbollah to carry troops and family homes were used to store weapons. The US First Lady Melania Trump has denied having a relationship with the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein in a surprise public address from the White House. She called for a congressional hearing for survivors, but some of them have criticised her, saying it shifts the burden onto victims.
Thank you, Jane. 24 minutes to nine now. We see you, the Defence Secretary declared in Downing Street yesterday as he revealed that Russian deep-sea submarines have been spying on underwater cables and pipelines supplying this country with data and energy. After that news conference, John Healy spoke to Newscast about what Russia was trying to do.
This time it was a combination of three submarines, and we tracked them 24/7. For over a month with allies to make sure that we are able to say to Putin, we see what you're doing, we're watching you. And it means also that if there is ever any damage to our cables or our pipelines, we know we can hold Putin to account. We know he can't deny it. And it also demonstrates to people, I think, that despite full focus on the Middle East, you know, armed forces 24/7 are also doing the job of protecting our homeland.
That was John Healy. Well, joining us, one of his predecessors, Secretary of State for Defence in the last Conservative government, Sir Ben Wallace. Good morning to you, Sir Ben.
Good morning, Nick.
For those of you in the know, the name Googie will be familiar, but to most of the rest of us, it isn't. They're quite a threat, aren't they? Tell us more about them.
Yeah, I mean, the Googie is an organisation specifically around sort of intelligence gathering, sabotage and protection of Russian assets and sensors itself. It started actually in the 60s within the Navy of Russia and then became what we know it today, really, in the mid-1970s. And it's not controlled by the Russian Navy, which is the first point. It really comes from the Russian Ministry of Defence and the GRU. That's, for those of you who remember Skripal, that's the Russian military intelligence organization that does a lot more than just gather information on, you know, British tanks and is very proactive in operating effectively, as they would see it, behind enemy lines. And so the orders that that organization gets pretty much comes from the top. Its function is, as I said, a range of areas. But when it comes to the United Kingdom, we are vulnerable because our navies have effectively diminished in the last 30, 40 years. While at the same time, this organisation has actually never stopped growing and being invested in. You know, in 1991, at the end of the Cold War, effectively, other Russian defence budgets got crunched, but not this. And so they now have a pretty impressive capability, and we're all trying to play catch-up.
And a capability to go very deep as well, deeper than our own submarines can go. Is it enough, therefore, for the Defence Secretary to simply tell Moscow, we know you're there, we see you?
Well, I mean, there may be things that the Ministry of Defence is doing proactively to deter Russia, and that would remain secret. It is a very secret world under the water effect for the submarine service, you know, nicknamed the Silent Service. You know, those sort of what they do and what we do, and in my time as well, is never discussed. But ultimately, we've got to be shown, we've got to show Russia we have a follow-up. It's not enough to say we see you and then let, almost on the same day, a Russian, you know, a shadow tanker bimble down the channel. And, you know, despite the Prime Minister's statements that he's going to do something about this shadow fleet, nothing at all is done. We you know, we risk being slightly laughed at by Putin, you know, if we're just all words and no action. And I think You know, we have started investing. You know, under my watch, I commissioned the RAF Proteus, which is a specific ship to protect our cables. It was delivered even on my watch. And, you know, that's a first of a kind for us. And it's one of the first in Europe. But we've still got to do more. We've got to have greater availability, because what this also shows is the threats are 360. It's not a, we can't live in an either or world where we have to protect our assets, our trade and our friends in the Gulf, or we have to protect our homeland. We have to protect both. And, you know, I hear Lord Darrick on your programme earlier. He's absolutely right. We've got to start investing. Many people across the political divide agree with it. This is not a Labour versus Conservative spat. But we've got to get the government of the day to start, continue to invest properly.
Yeah, you know what ministers say when they're asked about it. They often quote you. They say Ben Wallace once said that the British Army and our armed forces more generally have been hollowed out. In other words, they suggest you were confessing that it was the Conservatives who had failed to invest. How do you change the conversation in a way that makes it plausible for anyone to get elected saying, we won't spend money on the things you might want us to, hospitals, schools and the like, we will spend on tanks and planes?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to be honest in this political debate. You know, I never said it as this Labour government continually spins. And they know I never said it because it was challenged by numerous amounts of journalists, including from the BBC. What I had said as Defence Secretary, when I got the record funding since the Cold War, another sleight of hand by this current government, is that both Labour and Conservative and coalition governments hollowed out defence. It's been a 30-year programme of taking money out of defence, being spent on all the other things that you've just listed, benefits, hospitals, etc. So we need to be honest with the public. Let's all be honest. You know, there are people in all our parties. You know, I used to be supported by Barry Shearman of the Labour Party from Huddersfield. He was always talking about how Labour and the Tories needed to spend more defence. So we need to be honest about that. We also need to be very, very honest about the threat. And the threat grows. And as it grows, our funding should grow. And we get hints of the threat. And what John Healey revealed, you know, only a few, you know, recently, is a hint that we're under attack often. But governments don't like to share the threat, partly because of security, and I fully understand that side of it, but partly because they don't want to have that difficult decision of, well, do I have to cut benefits or welfare in order to fund our security?
I suspect it's a conversation that has begun, isn't it, Sir Ben? Sir Ben Wallace, thank you for joining us. We will continue that conversation longer on another day. Thank you.
17 minutes to nine, Hungary goes to the polls on Sunday with its Prime Minister Viktor Orban facing one of his toughest electoral challenges yet after 16 years in power. It is being described as the most consequential vote in Europe in 2026. Now, Europe editor Katja Adler is here to tell us why. Morning, Katja.
Good morning.
So just explain why this matters so strongly, obviously in Hungary, but far beyond.
Yeah, I mean, it is a really good question, Anna, because Hungary is tiny, right? You've got fewer people who live there than in Belgium, where I am at the moment. Hungary's GDP is a bit less, or around 1% of the EU's total GDP, but it really is being watched internationally. I think a lot of the focus right now is because of the times that we're living in. I mean, there's a concern amongst so many that we're seeing a backsliding in democracy internationally, that multilateral organizations, you know, where countries work together, that they're being eroded, that we're living in times where might is seen as right. And who are the two key international backers of Viktor Orban? Well, I mean, he is the father of what he infamously called illiberal democracy at home. And backing him is Donald Trump. He's endorsed him many times. J.D. Vance, despite the war in Iran, was just in Budapest to support Viktor Orban ahead of the election. He's seen as a figurehead of the Christian national right. But he's also been really useful over the years, his 16 years as prime minister, to Vladimir Putin. He's delayed EU sanction packages against Moscow, most recently since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. He's currently blocking a 90 billion euro loan from the EU to Ukraine, which Kyiv said it needs to survive. So, I mean, here in Brussels, and I mean, in a lot of European capitals, they won't say it directly. They're not unhappy that Viktor Orban is tipped to lose. He's seen as an obstructor in Brussels, not just on Ukraine, but also on migration and more. And there has been continuous concern about the backsliding of the rule of law, the independence of the judiciary, media freedom, LGBTQ plus and women's rights at home. And there's also some who say that if Viktor Orban loses, it will be such a headline that perhaps it'll be an indication more broadly in Europe that the rise of the hard nationalist right is slowed down. If you look at regional elections just recently in France, where Marine Le Pen's party didn't do as well as they'd hoped. And of course, Brussels is extremely worried about the French presidential election next year. So those are some of the reasons why Hungary's election resonates really way beyond its borders, I'd say.
Yeah, I've noticed as well just in the last hour, and this is not the first time we've heard this, but Viktor Orban has accused the opposition of organised attempts, he's saying, to disrupt the vote. Why is he struggling now after so long in power, Katya? Because 16 years is a decent stint for anyone.
Yeah, it's a big old stint. Well, I think a lot of people talk about corruption, you know, that massive allegations of corruption surrounding Viktor Orban. But in Hungary, corruption for a long time was seen as sort of being baked into the system to a certain extent. And as long as Hungarians felt that they were doing okay, then they were willing to accept the system as it was. That is absolutely no longer the case. I mean, since the end of COVID, since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, rising inflation in Hungary, you have Hungarians bitterly complaining about the state of their hospitals, the state of their schools, you know, the cost of food. And even though Viktor Orban has done, which something he always does before elections, which is, you know, sort of bring in tax incentives or in little treats, if you like, for voters that he's chasing. It's just not enough when people feel it's hard to make it to the end of the month. And they look at, for example, the sort of palatial building that Viktor Orban's father is building, or the fact that his son-in-law is one of the richest people in Hungary, that his close friends are the leaders of institutions right across Hungary, whether it's the judiciary, whether it's to do with energy and more and more and more. And that now is biting, and that is making it much easier for the new opposition party that's been around now for 2 years. So it's seen as untainted, if you like, because it is so new. It's also conservative, like a lot of the Hungarian electorate. That's why it's gaining a lot of traction. Many Hungarians saying enough is enough. But we have to be careful, Anna, because in 16 years, Viktor Orban has made constitutional changes to the electoral system. For example, he does largely dominate the media landscape. And that is why year after year within elections, you do have international election monitors that say these are free elections in Hungary, but they're not fair. So even though the polls are indicating that Viktor Orban is likely to lose, will he actually? I mean, there are many outcomes that could be possible on election day.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Katya, thank you for your insight. As always, Katya Adler, our Europe editor.
It is now 12 minutes to nine. Jan Morris, the historian, author and travelled writer, would have been 100 this year. The story of her life, one of the most remarkable of the 20th century, is told in a new biography. Morris reported on the first ascent of Everest, the Eichmann trial. She interviewed Che Guevara. She chronicled her own gender transition when James Morris became Jan. She wrote about it in her memoir, Conundrum. Many know her for her Pax Britannica trilogy, a still vaunted survey of the British Empire, though not one inevitably without controversy. We'll hear from her biographer in just a moment, but here, with a little memory of Jan, is her speaking to Michael Palin back in 2016 on the BBC's Arts Night, describing her perilous descent from Mount Everest in 1953.
We had to go down through the ice fall, which is still the most dangerous part of Everest. When we stumbled down to the ice, I was hopeless. I lost everything. I tripped over. I got tangled up with ropes and things.
Did you ever fear that you might not get the story out or someone else will pick it up?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So you were driven by sort of panic.
Certainly, yes. Yeah. All the same, there were moments on this journey down, which really was rather exciting, though I say it myself. Yeah.
Rather exciting. Sums up the life. Well, I've been speaking to the author of that biography, Sarah Wheeler, and I asked her to explain the life of Jan Morris for someone not familiar with her work.
I would describe her as a monumental presence in the cultural life of our time and an irresistible mix of glitter and the dark side. James Bond meets Joan Rivers.
What a wonderful description. Now, when you talk about the events of our time, one really shouts out when we think of Jan Morris, doesn't it? Everest and the conquest back in 1953.
Yeah, it's one of the greatest stories ever told. Morris was the journalist who was embedded, as we would say now, with John Hunt's expedition up the mountain. And her job was to get the story home. Easier said than done. Even though she had the exclusive, every other newspaper in the world had their guy hidden behind a glacier to intercept the Sherpas, the Sherpa runners who are bringing the message down, to give them 5 rupees and get the exclusive themselves. So Morris's journey on Everest was this one long scream of anxiety. The last message in code, for example, had to be sent through a radio operator in Namche who powered the radio on a stationary bicycle. So it was kind of dad's army, and she got the message home in time for the coronation. So, a new Elizabethan age indeed, all the headlines said.
And the use of that code meant she got the scoop, the time.
She got the scoop. And it made Jan Morris the most famous journalist in the world overnight. She was 26 and it set her off. Well, what we know, this absolutely astonishing career, 58 books, endless scoops, broke the story of Suez collusion, God knows what, but started on the icy slopes of Everest in 1953.
And for many who love Morris's works, it's the travel books in particular, and one really stands out, doesn't it? Venice. I remember reading that for the first time. Captures what makes that city so special.
Yeah, Venice, which came out in 1960 and monopolised the bestseller list on both sides of the Atlantic for weeks on end. For the first time, Morris, the writer, put herself into the story, and it made all the difference. It was the secret ingredient. It was like alchemy. She describes living on the Grand Canal in a palazzo with her family. For example, the postman used to arrive at the on the ground floor and shout out, "Maurice!" And they'd lower a basket down and they'd put the letters in and they'd haul it back up again.
We've referred to her as she all the way through it. But of course, in the early years, not she. He, James Morris, who transitioned to become Jan and was one of the most public people to transition and indeed to write about that, an extraordinary book called Conundrum. How much did she want that to define the way she's seen? How important a part of your biography is it?
Morris certainly didn't want it to define her, but she wanted to show us her own journey battling with the difficult questions of identity. And when you think that she was doing that while all of this other stuff, world events, were swirling around her and she was forging on with her career. But I do think that Conundrum and the response to Conundrum, the critical response to Conundrum in 1974, really shows us a huge amount about the state of the debate today. Debate is rather dignifying it. But she was curiously contemporary in so many ways. I mean, I have to say at the moment, 1950s, in being a foreign correspondent in the Middle East, she was there reporting when the Iranian Prime Minister nationalised oil, the fruits of which were flowing overwhelmingly to Britain. And so often, and I was writing her life, I could see things that are happening then foreshadowing, as she saw and described. She saw the first American oil men descending the rickety steps of planes on the desert sands in the Middle East in the 50s with golf bags over their shoulders. There were no golf courses in the whole region.
Contemporary, charismatic, you used the word glitter, you also used the word dark. This was a book you wrote because one of her children wanted you to. And it's not easy, is it, what you learn about the relationship between Morris and her children?
Look, there's no truth in any biography. A biographer who sets out to present the truth is always going to be foiled. And what I tried to show was the nuance and the light and the shade. But yeah, there is a dark side. Just as in her presentation of Empire, I wasn't very keen on the fact that she sweeps away savagery to the tune of a bugle reveille. And I think that one has to accept the light and the shade, and that's what a biographer's job is.
There's a devastating phrase that you quote, used by her son Henry when asked to describe their relationship.
Yes, we were introduced once, he said of Jan.
Introduced once,
his parents.
His father,
yeah.
Then later.
So I tried not to shy away from the dark side while obviously respecting the privacy.
Sarah Wheeler describing Jan Morris in her new biography.
It's 5 to 9. The decades-long quest to find Paul McCartney's lost Hofner bass has been captured in a new TV documentary. It's on BBC Two tomorrow evening. It traces the whole story from the guitar being stolen from the back of a van in 1972 to finally being found again in 2024. Arthur Carey's with us, BAFTA award-winning documentary maker who directed McCartney, The Hunt for the Lost Bass, and Naomi Jones as well, investigative journalist who launched the Lost Bass Project back in 2023. Morning, both.
Morning.
Morning. Morning, Anna.
Naomi, for people who don't know this remarkable story, I suppose it's about what happened to the bass in that lost period and why, because he's so synonymous with that one instrument, isn't he? In a way that some artists are, but many aren't.
Absolutely. So this was Paul's first bass. It was the bass that he got back in 1961 in the early Hamburg days. And it's the bass that's on all of that early Beatles music that really launched Beatlemania. And, you know, this is an exploration of what it means, this bass, an instrument to the museum and to the musician as well. So, he's completely synonymous with that bass, with the Beatle bass.
Yeah, that he didn't have for so many years until, Naomi, you started getting involved and trying to search for it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the last sighting of the bass was in 1969. And then several years later, so sort of going back to 2016, Nick Voss from Hofner decided to launch a search for the bass. And after a number of years sort of looking at different leads, he didn't really get that far. And then we joined, my husband and I, so Scott Jones, who's a journalist as well, and myself, we joined back in 2023. And we were able to bring our investigative skills to that search.
And to track it down. And Arthur, what is a story to tell as a documentary maker, particularly because it had a happy ending?
Yeah, no, it's an incredible opportunity to make a film about an icon, you know, a genius. And to find an alternative route into Paul's story in the Beatles' history via an instrument that connects him with, as it turns out, ordinary people and ordinary homes. I think it says a huge amount about Paul that he's so tickled by the journey the bass took. And to see an 83-year-old man connected with his past, you know, with his 18-year-old self holding this object again, it was an extraordinary thing to witness.
Yeah. Where was it in the end, Arthur?
Well, that would be maybe saying too much, but it was discovered.
No spoilers. OK.
It was discovered in a loft, and there are ambulance drivers involved and the early 70s rock band Hawkwind. So it's a real shaggy dog story. But in a way, the bass is a sort of MacGuffin for a film about Paul and about the Beatles and Paul's relationship with the Beatles, but also about fandom and memory and nostalgia and the enduring power of music.
Yeah, and as you say quite rightly, actually, and I realise it when you said it a moment ago, it is a story that is so well told so many times in so many ways that actually finding a new rich angle is a really special thing.
Yeah, that's exactly what excited me. It feels like there aren't too many opportunities to tell new stories about Paul McCartney, about the Beatles. So it was a real joy using this object to trace 65 years of history. And so much of the story, you know, is when this bass is away from Paul and with, as I say, ordinary people in ordinary homes.
Yeah. And Naomi, you can now set up as a private eye on the side, finding beloved lost items for people. That's a new career path for you.
Well, it's quite interesting because of the search for the bass and because we found the bass, we've had lots of contacts from you know, different guitar hunters to see if we can help. So the Funk Machine, which is James Jameson's bass, went missing in the 1980s. And actually, Paul talks about James Jameson and how much he was an inspiration for his bass playing. So it would be lovely if we could help with